Okay, this is Dr. Richard Varone. It is October 3rd, 2002, and we are conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Elmer D. Hale. And I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University Special Collections Library in the interview room. And Mr. Hale, where are you now? You are?
I'm in Flat Rock, Illinois.
Okay, Flat Rock, Illinois. Very good. Sir, if we could begin, just tell me a little bit about yourself. Where were you born and when were you born?
Okay, I was born July the 8th, 1945, mm-hmm. in Lawrenceville, Illinois.
Okay. And growing up, did you have any kind of memories of any... Were your family members in the military, or your father or grandfather, or any kind of military influence in your life there growing up?
Not really, Richard, no.
Okay. So when you... Did you go through high school?
Yes, sir.
Okay, graduate high school. And from there, did you go to college or did you start working?
Well, if we can back up just a minute, Richard,
sure.
I'll fill you in a little bit more. I probably should have done this earlier, but I didn't. I'm from a broken home.
Okay.
My grandmother pretty much raised me until 1962, okay. And when she passed away, I was put out to a home there in Lawrenceville, and I actually ended up going to a couple that lived in Pinkstaff, Illinois.
Okay.
My mother was a mental patient, and she couldn't take care of me. This wasn't a problem that was hereditary. She didn't, inherit this. She had an accident that caused this problem.
Okay.
But yes, I did graduate from high school. I was behind the other kids because we moved so much when I was younger. I never had a chance to get settled down, mm-hmm. and wasn't able to attend school for very long a period of time at any one location. After I graduated from high school, I went to electronics school in Louisville, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I had no transportation while I was down there. I had a menial job, mm-hmm. didn't pay much. I went 6 months down there, ended up coming back home, mm-hmm. and... Within, I think, 4 months, 3 months, I was in the service.
Really? Okay. I see here that you entered in the service. You were age 22.
That's probably correct, yes.
Okay. What about your father? Was he around at all?
He was, but I had no contact with him.
Okay. And so your grandmother basically raised you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And so when you returned, I guess, to Lawrenceville, how did you volunteer? Were you drafted?
I was drafted.
Okay. And how were you informed? Through the mail or?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay. Do you remember how you felt when you realized you were being drafted into the U.S. Army?
Well, I don't really remember, Richard, how I did feel. I guess I had no concept of what was down the road,
okay.
so to speak, you know, because
right.
I didn't have any military influences in my background, so therefore I really didn't know what was ahead of me.
Okay.
And I just took it in stride and went on.
How much did you know about the Vietnam War at the time?
Very little.
Okay. Did you think that when you were drafted that you might be going there, or is that how did you see that?
When I was drafted, I didn't think of going to Vietnam until after I had completed basic, and I got my MOS, and my MOS was, of course, 11B, and that was light weapons infantry, and I knew then that that's where I was headed.
Right. Right. Okay, so where did you do your basic training?
Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
Can you tell me about that? How was overall?
Well, I didn't have a problem really per se with the training, Richard. I mean, I was in pretty good shape and everything, and I was kind of raised kind of in the country, you know. I grew up with a gun for the most part of my life. I didn't have a problem with it. I'm not saying I enjoyed it, because it wasn't a time where, you know, you didn't get a lot of enjoyment out of being in the service, but, you know, we trained, 16 hours a day, 17 hours a day, whatever, and I just really never had a problem with it. I mean, I probably needed the discipline at the time. I wasn't what you call a rowdy kid or a jailbird or anything like that. I mean, you know, I just, but I think it helped me to grow up some. And,
how long were you in training?
I was in training at Fort Leonard Wood for 8 weeks.
8 weeks. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what was the most challenging aspect of that training, would you say?
Oh, probably the physical part.
Okay.
Physical part and some of the mental stress that some of the officers put us through, although I handled that well.
Okay. Did you have any contact with your family, with your grandmother, while you were in basic?
Well, my grandmother passed away in 62, Richard, so I wouldn't have had any contact with her.
Oh, okay.
I did have some contact with a girl that I was dating, plus the people that raised me, Mary and Tony Hill, in Pinkstaff, Illinois.
Okay. So this was basically, what, 1968?
This was 67.
67. Okay,
yes.
67. Were there any injuries there at basic, do you remember?
Oh, from me?
Yeah, well, from you or from any of the men in your company or platoon?
I didn't have any injuries.
Uh-huh.
I can remember, one guy breaking his leg and, you know, but as far as real thing, anything real bad, like somebody getting hurt with a weapon, no, I don't recall. There was none of that, no.
Okay, okay. What kind of weapons training did you receive there at Fort Leonard Wood?
We had, let's see, let me think just a minute, Richard.
Sure.
We trained with the M14.
Okay.
We also had training with hand grenades.
Mm-hmm.
And it runs in my mind that after we trained with the M14, they switched us to the M16.
Okay.
And with the M14, I done well with it. The M16 I didn't do so good on, you know, but that's one aspect of the training that I really enjoyed.
The weapons, you know, training.
Oh, yeah.
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 What was your personal preference of weapons that you handled there?
Well, I guess, let's see, Richard. I guess that depends on the situation a person's in.
Right.
If I'm in a combat situation, I want that M16.
Okay.
You know, for everyday weapon, or, you know, maybe for hunting purposes or sniping or something, that M14 is hard to beat.
There in your basic training, how would you rate that training? Did it prepare you for what you were getting ready to get into in Vietnam?
Let's see. I think maybe it did somewhat, Richard,
mm-hmm.
but not like it did in AIT.
Okay. How about your instructors there in basic? How were they?
I would rate them as excellent overall.
Okay. Did they talk to you about the potential of you guys going into combat in Southeast Asia, or did they just concentrate more on training you in the basics?
I think they concentrated more on training us, Richard. I don't recall any one of our DIs or our officers talking about Vietnam.
Did they talk about any of their previous combat experience, perhaps, in the Korean War or before?
No.
I'm just wondering if, the reason I'm asking these questions is wondering what, you know, what was your personal exposure to this, them telling you, okay, here's what a combat situation is like, this is how you need to be prepared for, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So basically in basic training, you did not have a lot of exposure to any kind of combat stories or what might lie ahead.
No.
Okay. Okay.
Richard, I need to take just a break.
Okay, sir. I'll pause it.
Hold on.
Okay. This is Richard Verone. We are continuing the oral history interview. This is the second session with Elmer Hale. Mr. Hale, before we began recording, you told me that there are a couple of things that you would like to add to what we had done before. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, I guess one of the things that I can really think of right off the top of my head, Richard, when I was in basic training down at Fort Leonard Wood, we done a live fire exercise.
Okay.
And what it was they had pits
mm-hmm.
that were dug out, of course, and then up around that they had sandbags, maybe a couple, three high.
Mm-hmm.
And in these pits they had explosives that they set off periodically.
Okay.
And we also had to negotiate barbed wire that was, you know, not real high off the ground that you had to crawl under. And then on top of that they were shooting I think it was M60s over
okay.
our heads, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we never had any problem there. I mean, as far as our guys, you know, panicking or anything, I guess, you know, they did once in a while, and they'd lose a guy. But,
right.
you know, but that was the only thing that I can really think of that I possibly left out there.
Okay. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Not at this time, Richard.
Okay.
Just can't think of it right now.
Okay, that's fine. Just let me know.
Okay.
We had left off when you had basically completed your journey across the Pacific Ocean, and
mm-hmm.
you had landed in Binwa,
mm-hmm.
coming from Manila. What was your feeling? Do you remember your thoughts and feelings when you stepped off the plane, when that door opened and you got down the steps?
Oh, yeah. I can never forget the stench.
Really?
I'm talking about the open sewers, you know, just, I mean, these people, didn't really know what a bathroom was or anything. I mean, they just, when they had to go to the bathroom, that's where they went, right there.
Right.
You know, and, I guess the heat, you know, was, unbelievable. And, of course, our living, well, let me back up.
Okay.
When we got off the plane there, of course, those are the two things that really hit me, you know, was the stench and the heat. I guess from there they loaded us onto a a bus, you know, just like a school bus. Mm-hmm. And over the windows they had these screens. And I thought, man, you know, what's these screens for? Well, somebody asked her, you know, maybe the sergeant told us, you know, that it was keep the people from throwing hand grenades and stuff into the bus, you know, and all this. And I thought, wow, you know.
Yeah.
And they took us down to, I think it was called the 90th Replacement Center.
Okay.
And, I mean, this place was huge. And I couldn't venture to say how many guys was there, Richard, but I'm sure it was in the thousands.
Okay. Processing in?
Yes.
Okay.
And this is where they processed us in. And every day, I think maybe two or three times a day, I don't recall for sure, but they'd have formations and stuff. And they'd have these guys stand up with these bullhorns and say, you know, so-and-so, you're going to here and here and here, you know. And one of the things I remember very vividly was I heard a lot of guys talking about, you know, you didn't want to go to the 4th Infantry Division.
Okay.
Because it was, you know, pretty much a... I guess it was kind of rough, you know. I'll put it that way.
Meaning rough, as in they had seen a lot of combat.
Yes. Uh huh. And the terrain wasn't, you know, the terrain we worked in wasn't great. I mean, you know, you really worked your butt off, you know.
Right.
And I thought, man, you know, I don't want to go there. Well, that. When my name was called, that's where I was headed.
Hmm.
And I thought, geez, oh, Peach, you know, just my luck, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they had guys going to 1st Cav, and they had guys going to the 4th, and they had guys going to the 9th, and, I mean, just everywhere, you know, all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember loading up on a C-130. And I had never been in a C-130 that I don't recall ever being in one until then.
Mm-hmm.
These planes are not pressurized, or they weren't then.
Mm-hmm.
And we got on this thing, and we was all sitting on the floor, you know, and I don't know. We took off and headed north to Pleiku Air Force Base. And on the way up there, I don't know how high we were, but I thought my head was going to explode, Richard. I mean, it was the pressure was so great, and I couldn't relieve the pressure. I tried swallowing, I tried blowing, I tried everything, you know, and I was the only one that seemed like on the plane that it was really affecting. I mean, I was in misery.
How long was that flight? Do you remember?
Oh, just off the top of my head, I'm going to say 30, 40 minutes.
Okay.
Maybe not even that, Richard. I mean, it's not, Vietnam's not a big country,
right.
You know, size of California maybe. But
right.
It could have been longer, but I just really don't think it was. And I was affected from that for about 3 days.
Really?
I mean, it really done a number on me. But that's the only time that they ever done that to me.
Hmm.
And I flew in them after that, and I never ever had that problem. But I don't know why it didn't the first time, but it did.
Okay.
Anyway, we got to Pleiku to Air Force Base, and then they come in and picked us up in a convoy and took us into a place called Campanari.
Okay.
I recall, but I don't think this is correct. I recall Campanari as being west of Pleiku, but I don't think it was. I think it was a little bit south, but I'm just not real sure.
Okay.
And it wasn't too far from Pleiku, maybe 10, 14 miles, if it was that far. Campanari got its name from a first lieutenant that was killed in that area, and I don't recall the year, whether it was 65, 66, when it was, but that's where Campanari got its name. That was from a gentleman by the name of Mark Anari.
Okay. Do you know, is that A-N-A-R-I? Anari?
I think it's E. E-N-A-R-I or something like that, Richard. If,
okay.
If you guys got a directory down there, it'll tell you.
That's we do, and that's what I'll
okay.
check. So.
Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Good enough.
Anyway, they took us in there to this base camp, and we were assigned to companies and battalions. And I remember they took us down to and got our equipment, and we were issued a rucksack and poncho liners and canteens and everything you needed. And I think it might have been the next day they took us in and assigned us a weapon.
Okay.
And, these weapons looked like something come over on the Mayflower. I mean, they were in bad shape. I mean, that was my opinion, you know. Well, and we were standing there and around this big table in a kind of a horseshoe or U-shape, you know, and I asked this guy that was passing out the weapons. I said, I wasn't trying to be smart. Like I just, you know, I said, this thing, fire. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, he said, it's good to go. And I said, boy, I mean, it did. It looked bad, Richard. I mean, I just couldn't believe it, you know.
Were these M14s or M16s?
They were M16s. They were the early version of the M16.
So they had probably been in the field, recycled
back from
you guys.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think we were there like I'm guessing at least 7 months before they come out with the new ones.
Okay.
And but
how long was it when you landed in Benoit to you got the Plo Koo until you got assigned your weapons? About how long was this? How many days?
Yeah, 3 days.
I'm sorry, say that again, you broke up?
3 days.
3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. How are you feeling? I mean, this is a big thing that's happening to you here.
Well, I don't know, Richard. It's really kind of hard to say. I was.
Sorry, Mr. Hill?
I guess.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Sorry, we were breaking up there.
Okay, let me get off this headset, Richard.
Okay.
I prefer to work with this thing, but evidently it's not going to let me.
Okay.
Hold on.
Okay.
I don't know, Richard. It was kind of hard to grasp, I guess, at the time. I was kind of naive about things. I come from a background that where I didn't really have a mother and father, and I wasn't bothered by a lot of this like a lot of guys were. I never ever got.
Hello?
I never felt that.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
I don't know why. Maybe I'm just odd by that way. I don't know. I just never really felt that. Never had time to feel like that, Richard.
Okay.
But at the time, I guess I was, maybe kind of trying to figure out, you know, what the heck was going on, you know. I mean, and what we was doing over there. And, you know, a lot of this never hit me until, like, maybe 7-8 months down the road, you know.
Okay.
And we did have a little bit of training there at the base camp once we were issued weapons, and they took us out on a couple little exercises, I think. They took us out to the firing range, zeroed the weapons, and this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically from that time on, we were assigned to different companies.
Okay. Okay. Was this 1968?
This is 67.
67, okay.
It's November 67.
Okay.
And I was assigned to Charlie Company, the 1st Battalion, 22nd Infantry. And they basically loaded us up after about a week there in base camp, loaded us up.
Mr. Hill?
They took us and dropped us off to these different camps.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Let's see, where were we at, Richard?
You were talking about they took you out on training, and you did a couple of exercises, and then...
Oh, yeah, okay. Then they loaded us up on the helicopters and took us out to the companies. Mm-hmm. And I remember flying in that helicopter, and I mean, you know, all you seen once we got out of the base camp area, I mean, it was all green. I mean, it was just like, you know, a big forest down there, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought, gee, boy, I hope these guys know where they're going, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And next thing you know, I mean, we were circling a place over, you know, in the jungle, and they brought us down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a shock. You know, when you walk into a group of men that you know, maybe has been there a while, and you feel kind of, I guess you'd call it inferior,
mm-hmm.
you know. Most of the guys, I won't say they were reluctant to, well, I guess they would be. They were reluctant to have anything to do with us because, you know, we didn't know nothing. We didn't know squat.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of hard to really get to know, you know, what was going on, and
right.
It took time to bond with these guys.
Mm-hmm.
But once you did, I mean, you was in.
How many people there were in that group when you got off the chopper and you went and joined them? I guess on, you know, where they were, you were replacements, obviously.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so, how many men were in this one group? Approximately.
This is just a guess on my part, Richard. I'm guessing maybe 75.
Okay.
At the most. And we as a company were never up to strength.
Okay.
If I remember right now, don't quote me on this, Richard, but I think a company consisted of like 125 or 30 men.
Mm-hmm.
And we never ever had that many people. Okay. Well, I take that back. We did one time. We did one time, but that was pretty much the norm. I mean, you know, anywhere from 60 to 75 people.
What would you say was the morale of the people you were with, the American troops that you came down with there?
I thought it was pretty good. You know, for the conditions that they were living in and conditions that I lived in for a year, I think we've done as well as an animal can exist. I mean, you know, to really put it bluntly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we've done. I mean, we were a bunch of animals. I mean, that's the way we lived.
Right.
You know, you lived in holes, and mm-hmm. and you didn't get a bath and all this stuff. And but basically, overall, I think the morale was pretty good.
Okay. So what did you do? You joined this group, and do you remember what your first assignment was, your first mission was?
I'm not real sure, Richard, but I know I was introduced to my platoon sergeant,
mm-hmm.
and his name was Sergeant Mixon.
Okay.
And he was... kind of a rough character,
mm-hmm.
and I know he told me, you know, we hadn't been there very long, and he told me, he said, Hale, he said, He said, you screw up, so I'm going to send your ass to Long Bend Jail. Well, I didn't know what Long Bend Jail was, you know.
Right.
But I found out, you know, it's a place you didn't want to go.
Right, right.
But overall, you know, he was good to his guys, and he didn't do anything that he wouldn't ask you to do. I mean, you know.
What was your assignment in the platoon?
I was just a rifleman at the time.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And if I remember right, Richard, I think I went out on LP, and I think it might have been that night or the next night I went out on LP.
Long range patrol?
No, it was a listening post.
Okay.
And we had these, we sent these out in four-man groups in four different directions from the company.
Okay.
And we usually went out late in the evening, and we'd go to one spot, and we'd sit there till almost dark, and then we'd move. In case, you know, we were being watched, that maybe we could, you know, throw them off a little bit and give us some time to work. We set up trip flares at night, and we always had one man awake.
Okay.
Sometimes that person would fall asleep, but most of the time, you know, they done pretty good. And those were kind of an early warning, you know, if there was a ground attack on the company. But I think that was probably the first assignment that I was on, and you know.
How many ground attacks were there on your platoon? I mean, was this a common thing, or was it?
Well, really, Richard, from my standpoint, we didn't have what I can really remember as a ground attack. I mean, if it did, it was very, very, very few. Usually, not always, but usually the NVA or the VC would never attack an American company unless they knew they had us outnumbered.
Okay.
You know, they'd snipe us once in a while, you know, or snipe at us and this kind of stuff. But for the most part, I can never remember really having a full, fell-out ground attack from them on us.
Okay.
When we were set up.
Okay. What kind of contact with the enemy did you have?
Well, I was wounded twice over, if that tells you anything. Let's see. Let me think just a second, Richard. It was in November. I think it was in, I was trying to think, Richard, when the Tet broke out.
That would be in early 1968.
Okay.
So basically 2.5 months after you arrived in country.
Okay. When the Tet Offensive broke out, we were in, our company was in Dock Tow.
Mm-hmm.
And because they knew there was a big force of NVA to the west of Dock Tow that was going to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, when Kontum got hit in the Tet Offensive, why, they pulled our company out, probably well as some others. I don't recall just exactly who all was there.
Right.
And they pulled us down to Kontum.
Mm-hmm.
And from Kontum, we went through there, and it was house to house fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember. Let's see, Richard. I remember we was going house to house, and I had picked up a knife and an NVA flag and a couple of little things. I don't remember just exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. And we were going through these buildings and stuff, mm-hmm. and we were driving them north. And we got to this place. I don't really know what you would call it, Richard, but it was kind of a little. I mean, it was a pretty area. It was all grass, and then on both sides of this grassy area was little white buildings, and they were very nice. I mean, you know, and I didn't know what they were, and didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to them, I guess. And these NVA were inside these buildings, and we got some of them to surrender, mm-hmm. and they called that. Well, I guess they called it Chuhoy,
right.
what they called it.
Yes.
And anyway, we got some of them to surrender and some of them wouldn't. And I remember we had this one guy with us. I'm not going to mention no names, but anyway, I think there was three of them in this building. And he says to them, he says, you know, Chuhoy, you son of a bitches. Well, I mean, you know, they were repeating what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And hang on just a second, Richard, please.
Okay.
He said, he made this statement to him, you know, and they repeated it back to him.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did, well, they held up their arms and come to the door, mm-hmm. and he proceeded to kill them. With an M60,
okay.
And that kind of really opened my eyes, you know, a little bit. That, hey, you know, this shit's for real,
right.
you know. And we had a captain with us at the time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he's in Texas right now. He's a veterinarian down there,
mm-hmm.
and I think the world of the guy. But anyway, he was a West Point graduate.
Okay,
and. Very good man, and I really hadn't seen anything out of the way of him. I mean, as far as being, you know, aggressive or anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we had got behind one of the buildings, and we knew that there was some in the basement. They had basements in these little buildings,
mm-hmm.
and they wouldn't come out.
Okay.
And, I mean, we tried everything to get them out, and they wouldn't come out.
Okay.
And he made the comment. He said, "We'll get them out." And he took a white phosphorus grenade and threw in there. And, of course, that was into that.
Right.
And then we had captured a major,
mm-hmm.
there in Khantoum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, those people's, I guess you'd call it resilience or whatever you want to call it, Richard, really amazed me. This guy, we had him out there in that little grassy area,
mm-hmm.
all day long. I mean, it was hot. Never had no water. And never asked for anything. And come the end of the day, why they come in and took him by APC to a interrogation center. And he supposedly made the comment to his interrogators that had it not been for the 4th Infantry Division, that they would have taken Khantoum.
Hmm.
But in and around Khantoum right there, Richard, there's to the north edge of it, there was a MACV compound.
Okay.
And somehow, and I never did understand this and haven't yet to this day, but somehow the NVA had gotten in around that MACV compound and had dug a trench around that thing. Now, how in the world they done that, I mean, I just really don't know, but
mm-hmm.
anyway, they did. I think it was the next day we were going up, let's see, would have been to the west, I guess. We were going west up that street,
mm-hmm.
and we weren't sure, but we thought there was some down there in the trenches, you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we got down there. We found out real quick, you know, that's where they was at.
Okay.
And there was like six or eight of us guys, and we had a platoon sergeant with us. Mm-hmm. And his name was Sergeant Eyring. Eyring, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And they opened up on us with their weapons, and what kept them from killing any of us, I have no idea. I mean, we were real, real close, mm-hmm. you know. And me and this sergeant took off and went to the north a little bit across this road and got behind a big tree. And at this time, now I don't know how I got stuck with this job, Richard, but I did, but at this time I was carrying a radio.
Okay.
And this was the only communication that we had back to our company.
Okay.
And he and I were behind this big tree, and he was quite a bit smaller than I was. Mm-hmm. And I looked around that tree to see what was going on, and just about the time I did, I seen him shoot this B-40 rocket.
Mm. At your tree?
Yes. I thought, oh, shit, you know, and I made the comment.
Uh-huh.
I said, hang on, Sergeant, we're going to get shook, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, about that time, I mean, that thing hit that tree, and I slammed him up against the tree. He said he felt like he'd been hit by Dick Butkus. and I caught a little shrapnel from that down the right side of my body and my leg.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing major.
Okay.
And we finally got a hold of a tank, and he come down there and started working them over in that trench pretty good.
So you called in the tank?
Yeah, we called in the tank, and he come down there, and we got back up on the road, and we started down through the trench there, you know, of, I guess, you know, done away with, you know, that were
right.
wounded and stuff. I mean, they were just, there was no way they was going to survive. Mm-hmm. And
so you did not take them prisoner?
No, well, there yeah. wasn't, I mean, you know, they weren't, I mean, there was nothing there to take, Richard. I mean, they were dying.
Okay.
I mean, you know, we didn't mess around with them.
Did you just let them die?
Pardon me?
Did you just let them die there? I mean, since they were in such bad shape.
Well, we left them there and kind of helped them along.
Okay. Gotcha.
And then, let's see.
Now, were these were regular NVA or the EVC?
Yes, they were regular NVA.
Okay.
And then I think, Richard, from that, I think maybe it was either that evening, we stayed up there along the edge of the road, and the next day they moved us down towards a river, and I can't remember the name of this river.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, by that time, you know, this had been going on two or three days or whatever, and I remember setting up by this river,
mm-hmm.
and we had a tank or two with us, and there was a building, like one of those little buildings I was talking about there earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It was across the road, and I walked over there and was just kind of nosing around. Probably shouldn't have been, but I was.
Now, were you still with your radio, or did you have...
No, I did. I just had the M16 then. I had left the radio with one of the other guys.
Okay.
And it wasn't very far, just like across the street, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in there, and I could smell something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to stick my head in this room, and there was this NVA laying there. It was... pretty well decomposed. I mean, he was decomposing pretty quick.
Okay.
I turned around and left there and went back to the company. And I think we milled around there maybe a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
And up the road, not very far from us, probably less than a quarter mile, there was a big white building up there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had kind of moseyed down there, and I heard these heard these kids, you know, in this building, and I thought, what in the world is this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in there, and I mean, this place was full of orphans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, full of them. And I talked to this lady. She was a nun, and she was out of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, Richard, her first name might have been Patricia, but I'm not real sure about that.
Okay.
And she was an older lady at the time. She was in her 50s, I'm sure, at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And she came up there to me, and
she was with the orphans.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she was with a Catholic relief organization of some kind.
Okay.
And she came up there, and she wanted to know if she could help me. And I said, well, I said, I'm just outside here. I said, what is this place? And she said, well, I said, I run this orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, where do you get your funds, you know? And she said, well, I said, you know, the Catholic relief and all this, you know, and mm-hmm. and sometimes I can get some help through the military, you know, but not very often. And I talked to her for probably 30 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and she was very a very unique lady.
Mm-hmm.
She was a registered nurse, and she said periodically the NVA would come in there at night. Hold on just a minute, Richard.
Okay.
Would come in there at night and capture her and take her up in the mountains and would make her treat their people.
Okay.
And she done this on more than one occasion. How long she was over, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of, you know, walked out, and I thought, boy, you know, that's quite a woman, you know.
Yeah. Right in the middle of the war zone.
Yeah, right in the middle of a war zone, and all these mouths to feed and all these kids running around. I'm talking about little kids, Richard. I'm talking about, you know, toddlers on up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of moseyed back up to the company area where we was set up there by the river.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might have been the next day. we got this replacement in,
mm-hmm.
and he was a first lieutenant.
Okay.
And he was brand new to the company, brand new to the country and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose I just graduated out of OCS and all. And I mean, I can still see this guy and everything. And he had on brand new boots and fatigues and, I mean, everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And why he was put into this position, I have no idea. I guess it was because, I don't know, we were low on men. I really don't know, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he was told to take a platoon and go north of the orphanage across the river,
mm-hmm.
and just kind of recon the area.
And he was brand new to
He was brand
everything.
New. Yeah, yep.
And he was going to be in charge of a platoon.
Pardon me?
He was going to be in charge of a
yes.
platoon, a recon
yes.
platoon.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't really call it a recon platoon. It was just an infantry platoon.
Okay.
But that's what we call it, you know, just kind of recon there, see what's up there.
Mm-hmm.
And he went up there, and I don't suppose they had been gone an hour, if they'd been gone that long.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, all hell broke loose. I mean, I could hear the, you know, the machine guns and everything, you know, and I heard screaming on the radio, and a bunch of us jumped on a tank, and we all took off and went down there. Well, come to find out, they had run into a one guy. As far as I know at the time, that's all I ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy was dug in to a base of a tree, and I mean, he was just shooting the shit out of guys. I mean, you know, it was just utter chaos.
Right.
And we got up there, and we couldn't really get to this guy, you know, as far as taking him out.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we'd move, I mean, he'd pick one of us off. I mean, it was just, you know, I remember we, I don't know how many we lost up there, Richard, but I know we lost Sergeant Crawford, and we lost a colored boy, and I can't remember his name, but he had his arm blew off. I mean, it was a mess.
What was this? What was this guy firing?
I just really don't know, Richard, for sure.
Okay.
I'm guessing it had to be an AK.
Okay.
I mean, you know, because I just really don't know.
Okay.
I'm guessing it was an AK.
Okay.
And we couldn't get to him, and Sergeant Crawford was beside me, and he took a round between the eyes. And, I mean, it was something else. Anyway, we finally had to get a tank up there. And the tank come in behind us. Well, we had to get him to come go to the west a little bit and come around from the north. And he finally got behind this tree. And he stuck his head up over that turret, and I thought, geez, Pete, you're going to buy the farm, you know, here. Well, he kind of talked to us over the radio and said, where's this guy at, you know, and we told him, and they finally got rid of him.
Okay.
And from then we moved on up into the mountains there north of Kontum, and there had been some heavy fighting going on up there. And then from there, Richard, I think maybe they might have took us back in base camp for a day or two and took us back out to a different area.
Okay.
What
happened to that first lieutenant, the brand new guy?
Oh, I forgot about him, didn't I? he got killed.
Okay.
Yeah, he got killed the very first day. I mean, I don't know the guy's name. I just really don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, he was KIA in that group.
Okay. Do you need to take a minute?
Yeah, just a minute, Richard.
Okay.
Hold on.
Okay.
Now, from here on out, Richard, things kind of get a little fuzzy for me, with the exception of maybe a couple incidents.
Okay. Can I ask you... why do they get fuzzy? Is it that you can't remember, or you blocked it out?
I have, I pretty much can't remember, and I have, I've been going through counseling for over a year.
Yes, sir.
And I try not to dwell on this stuff, because it does bother me. And but we're, you know, I'll stick it out. I'll bear with you.
Okay. Okay, go ahead, sir.
Like I said, at this point, Richard, things get just a little bit fuzzy for me. But as I recall, they took us back into our base camp for maybe a day or two. And, of course, in an infantry outfit, you always got some guys that kind of resent people that are in the rear echelon. And I didn't, per se, I didn't really resent these guys until later on in my tour when I found out what they were doing.
You talking about people at the base camp?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And anyway, some of our guys proceeded to go up to the EM club, and, you know, they get in fights and all this other junk, you know. Well, the next morning, why, we were told to pack our bags. If we wanted to fight, that's what we were going to do. And they took us out into a different area. And this was, I don't know, Richard, exactly what month this would have been. I mean, it still wouldn't have been probably in March, I'm sure. I don't remember. But anyway, our next I think, just a minute, Richard.
Okay. Take your time.
I think about this time, Richard, I think about this time we was approaching April of 68.
Okay.
And between the March and the April, we just kind of run routine patrols.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we were all over the Central Highlands. We were from Docto to Bamitut.
Mm-hmm.
That was our area of operation.
Okay.
And it was a very rugged terrain. In fact, when I went over, Richard, I weighed 175 pounds, and I mean, I didn't have an ounce of fat on me.
Mm-hmm.
And a year later, when I came out of the country, I weighed 143 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, for some reason, you know, you work in that kind of an area, you never, ever get used to that type of terrain. I mean, it'll flat kick your ass. I mean, you know, you go uphill and there are mountains and down mountains and cross rivers, and it's really rugged. And you put up with the snakes and the scorpions and, you know, the mosquitoes and the leeches, it's very, very taxing, very tiring. In fact, I would venture to say, Richard, we spent at least 16 to 17 hours a day working. And I mean, this was every day. This wasn't just every once in a while. This was every day. And then at the end of the day, we were required to set up at night, build our bunkers, build sandbags, and I mean, this went on day after day after day after day. And
what was the mood of your platoon, I mean, during this hard work?
Well, we had a few guys, you know, Richard, that their tempers were short, and this, that, and the other. Of course, they tried to keep us resupplied as best they could with mail from back home and our SP packs that had the goodies and stuff in it, you know, and this kind of stuff. But I'll tell you, Richard, basically, I just remember, you know, our company had, I mean, it was fairly good. I mean, it really was. We had, and I don't want anybody to ever take me wrong. I don't want you to take me wrong. I don't want nobody down there to take me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'm a white man. And we had trouble with the Negroes.
Okay.
We really did.
Trouble.
We had guys that refused to go out on a patrol.
Hmm.
We had guys that would steal off of anybody and everybody, didn't make any difference where they were colored or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just basically troublemakers.
Right.
And you know, I'm not saying they didn't maybe experience that with us, Richard. I really don't know. I tried not to give anybody any trouble. I tried to do my job and you know, let it go with that.
Mm-hmm.
I had a knife pulled on me over there by a colored man.
Mm-hmm. Is this out in the field?
No, this was back in base camp.
Okay.
This was out actually back in base camp.
Okay.
You know, he threatened to kill me, and I basically, you know, said, "Hey, you want to cut? You go right ahead and cut, but you damn well better sure hope and pray you kill me, because if you don't, I'll kill you." And I would have. I was that far in, Richard, at the time. I mean, I was, and that's not proud. I'm not proud of that. Don't get me wrong. I'm not proud of that at all. But I was to the point where I had a gut full, you know. But, okay, getting back to April, Richard, we our company had moved like I said, Richard, where we was at over 9 times out of 10, I didn't even know what area we was in. I mean, I just knew we moved.
Right.
And, you know, one thing I do remember, this was in April, I think it was April the 24th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
We had 100 at this time. Now, this is one time, Richard, when we had several guys with. We had 122 guys. Now, the reason I know this is because I still got my little book that I kept track of our people, you know, how many we had in the weapons platoon and all this other stuff. And I think we had 122 guys, and that included the mortar squad that went with us and our company. And I was pretty much raised out in the country, and I'd done a lot of hunting when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And we went into this area, and I think it was south of Kontum at this time. I'm just not real sure, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in that area right there.
Okay.
And we went to this place, and we were, the whole company was walking in there. And we had this sergeant with us. His name was Sergeant Hollis Buck.
Hollis what?
Buck.
Okay.
And he was a career man. And he and I got to be real, real close.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong thing to do. But anyway, he'd been through Korea and through Pusan and all them over in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we got into this area that we were going to stay for the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Richard, the closer we got to this place, the quieter it became.
Is this a village you were heading toward?
No, this was a mountain.
Okay.
This was a mountain. It was called Chumor.
Okay.
But we got up there, and we was standing beside this tree, and I told Sergeant Buck, we called him Pappy because he was 38 years old. He was older than the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I said, Pappy, I said, something ain't right. He said, what do you mean? I said, there's some shit up here somewhere. I said, we're going to hit some shit. I said, I can just feel it. I said, you ever noticed the monkeys quit chirping and or the chattering and the birds quit singing? And I said, it's real quiet, isn't it? He said, yeah. I said, there's something around real close. And so our captain, he got like, I think it was 5 or 6 guys and had them to go up this mountain, you know, kind of seeing what was up there.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't get up there. They didn't go very far. And they had movement off on the right-hand side.
Mm-hmm.
And the jungle in that area, Richard, was so thick that this one kid threw a grenade and it bounced back on him.
Gosh.
And hit him in the back, and it took a chunk out of his back the size of my hand. And it was clear past his spine. I mean, he lived and everything,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, it really done a number on him.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next day, of course, they got him out of there and everything. And the next day, while we sent a patrol up there, and they just made mincemeat out of them guys. And unbeknown to us, there was a regiment on that hill of NVA.
Hmm.
And also unbeknownst to me at the time, and I did not know this until like in the last 2 years, Richard,
mm-hmm.
there was 4 other companies besides us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and Delta companies of the same battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all around that hill. But I mean, I didn't know anything about it, you know. And we were trying to get these, you know, try to go up, you know, get up this hill and take this place, you know. And, of course, it was so well fortified. I mean, you could not, you couldn't move. I mean, it was impossible. If they weren't, I mean, they were dug in, they were camouflaged so well that you couldn't even, you could be 10 feet in front of a bunker and never see it.
Wow.
In fact, the day that Sergeant Buck was killed, he was to my right, and we were going up this hill, and he turned around to bring the guys up behind him, bring them up on line, and I turned to look at him, and he was gone in an instant, just, you know.
A bullet.
Yeah, well, they raked him with a machine gun is what they done.
Good.
And we left. We had to leave his body up there. And another boy from New York, I can't remember this kid's name. They were left up there for 2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. And I remember, Richard, the third day that we went up this hill. Mm-hmm. And I remember this so vividly. Let me go back just a second. Before Sergeant Buck was killed, he made the comment to me. He said, "Elmer, had that hill been in Korea, said that son of a bitch would have been leveled." Mm-hmm. And we didn't get the artillery that we needed. They wouldn't give it to us.
Why not?
I have no idea, sir.
What about air support?
We had some, but not much.
Okay.
Well, I guess I'm kind of fibbing to you, Richard, when I tell you I don't know, and I don't want to get into it.
Okay.
I think it had to do with some personality conflicts throughout the company, or not maybe the company, but in the battalion, and it filtered down to the company. I'll put it that way.
Okay.
Therefore, it cost a lot of lives, and I thought that was the biggest damn waste of bullshit I'd ever seen in my life.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it.
You know, I mean, if you got a gripe with a man, take it to him, get it over with, forget it.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But anyway, I think it was the third assault that we went up there. We went up there 3 or 4 days in a row, tried to get them out of there, kidding. And we were getting ready to make the final assault up this hill. And, I was carrying a radio for our captain. And he started us out in line, and I turned around, and I says to him, I said, called him a name, and I said, you know, I don't want you to take me wrong, but I said, I got a question for you. He said, what's that? I said, is that goddamn hill worth these men's lives? I said, in my opinion, ain't worth shit. And he said, well, he said, I agree with you, but I've got to try. I said, why? He said, because if I don't, I'm going to lose my bars. You know.
Right.
And I understood where he was coming from, Richard, but also understood, and I think he did too, but he just didn't have no control over it.
Right.
I mean, he was told, you do this, and you do this, and you do this.
Right.
And he was following orders the same as I was following orders.
Right.
You know. And anyway, on the way up there, I mean, now, by this time, Richard, we had lost probably 3/4 of the men in this company.
Okay.
On that hill.
All right.
And we started up this hill, or we're started out of the little area we were set up in.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, Richard, I don't want anybody to take me wrong.
Right.
But I have a hard time dealing with Negroes.
Okay.
Because when we started up that hill, there was like 4 or 5 of these guys in a bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And they told our captain they wasn't going up there. And they didn't. And I made the comment to him. I said, Captain, if you'll let me, I'll take care of them guys. I mean, I was this crazy, Richard, at the time. I mean, I was stressed.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'll kill him. And I would have. I mean, I'd have stuck the M16 that gun, and I'd have done it. And I told him, I said, you know, they got killed by friendly fire.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't nothing. I mean, they couldn't. I say they couldn't if they might have been able to prove me guilty. I don't know. But I was very upset. And so we went ahead and tried to take this hill. We didn't get the job done. They brought the 1st of the 10th Cav in. That evening, I was on one of the last choppers out that evening.
Okay.
And we had 18 guys walking, Richard, after that.
Out of 100?
Out of 122. I'm going to quit. Okay.
Okay, sir. This is Richard Barone, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Elmer Hale. It is October 21st, Monday, and it is 1:30 in the afternoon. Mr. Hale, if you'd like to continue with the story, we were talking about this Battle of Chewmore Mountain and what had happened there. And we left off with some of the initial assaults upon this position. If you'd like to continue.
You still there, Richard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Let's see. I think it was the day following Sergeant Mixon's death.
Mm-hmm.
We were again ordered to take that particular position. At this point, Richard, I can't tell you exactly how many men we had lost, but we had lost several.
Mm-hmm. This is your company that was ordered to?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I for one, was in question, just what the hell we were trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And taking this particular position.
Mm-hmm.
And unbeknownst to me, at the time, there was three other companies in that area trying to do the same thing we were doing.
To the same position?
That's correct.
Okay.
And nobody was really making any headway.
Okay.
I mean, we were all getting, pretty much ground up.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the day following Sergeant Buck's death, as well as another gentleman from New York, and I can't remember his name,
mm-hmm.
We could not get these two men off of that hill because, you know, the fighting was so bad and fire was so intense that we just couldn't get them off.
How big was this hill, would you say?
Richard, I honestly do not know.
I mean, it was...
Now, are you talking about, when you say big, are you talking about in height or are you talking about in girth?
Both, really. What did it look like to you? You know, did you guys see basically the girth of the hill, or were you able to look up and see the summit? Or
yeah, you could look up and I say you could see it. No, you couldn't because the vegetation was so thick.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point we were close to the top,
mm-hmm.
But we got beat back.
Mm-hmm.
I just, it's really, really hard for me to say, Richard, how big that was. That's just beyond me. I just really don't know.
Okay.
You know?
The hill was covered with vegetation, or was it wooded?
Oh, yeah, it was jungle covered.
Okay.
Uh, Well, let me put it like this, Richard. If it's any help, and it's probably not. There were three other companies up there besides Charlie Company,
mm-hmm.
and we could not hear them firing.
Okay.
I'll put.
Are you there, Mr. Hill? Okay, go ahead, sir.
Okay, we could not hear the other companies firing, and did not know that there was other companies trying to take that particular position also.
Okay. You mean you guys had no idea actually at the time that other people were assaulting that position?
No.
Wow.
No. Absolutely none.
Lack of communication there.
Well, I don't know whether it was lack of communication, Richard, or whether it was just the lack of, you know, the higher-ups did not want us to know,
right.
You know, that there was anybody else around. I just really don't know. See, that's one of the things that I was always in question about. You know, why weren't we told, you know, hey, we had help on the other side, or we had this, we had that. We were never told that.
Right.
And I always kind of blamed the division level for that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's where they all operated in Vietnam. I don't know. I haven't really talked to other veterans about this particular battle or about anything that they went through. So therefore, I don't know how they operated.
Okay. Did this hill have a number? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh, Richard. No, I think it did, but I'd have to look back through my through some of my material, Richard, to find that number.
Okay.
If it does, the next time we talk, I'll have it for you.
Okay, great.
Anyway, the day following Sergeant Buck's death, we again tried to take this particular position, and we failed again.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, we were down to probably 18 to 20 guys at the most in this whole company.
Wow.
Out of 125 or 128 people. We lost a second, I think he was a second lieutenant up there. His name was Bill Zimmerman.
Okay.
In fact, he had been pulled out of the company,
mm-hmm.
to. Now, this is the way I remember this, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
He had been pulled out of the company to get ready to go to R&R,
mm-hmm.
to Hawaii, to see his wife.
Okay.
When we got in trouble at Chumore, he was called back out into the field, and I say called back. I say he volunteered to come back. He was asked to come back.
Okay.
And his words were, and I remember this very distinctly. He said, "All you guys are going to do is get my ass killed out there."
Hmm.
And he came back and had no more. Got off of the chopper and got into the perimeter, and he was killed. And matter of fact, I've been corresponding with through email,
mm-hmm.
with some of his people.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to get his medal upgraded from a. Let's see, what was it? A Bronze Star to a Silver Star, I think. And that was denied here in the last week or so.
Hmm. Oh.
anyway, that evening we were told that we were going to be pulled off of that mountain, and they sent, if I remember right, they sent a first of the 10th Cav in. And I was either on the last chopper out or the next to the last chopper out. And every chopper, of course, come in, they offloaded these guys, and we would get on. And I remember telling some of the guys from the Cav unit, you know, I said something, you know, keep your head down, or something to the effect, I said, keep your head down, you know, because that damn hill's crawling with them, you know. And like I said, I was on the next to the last chopper or the last chopper out. The Cav unit that went in there was gnawed up pretty good. They ended up pulling everyone off of that area, off the mountain there, Richard. And within a day or two, they brought the B-52s in. And from what I understand, this is from things that I heard later, that when they, after the B-52 strike, then they sent someone else in there. Now, who this someone else was, I don't know. But they sent a crew in there and to see what they could find or whatever. And at this time, they found Sergeant Buck and this other gentleman that I referred to that we left up there. I also heard, whether this is true or not, I don't know. I would love to know. But I also heard that Sergeant Buck, who was he was a career man, he had several tattoos on him, and supposedly the NVA carved him up pretty good. They took the they took a knife and cut the tattoos off of him. I also heard that they had cut his genitals off and stuck them in his mouth. And we were taken back to a fire base. Where at, Richard? I don't know where this was located.
You remember the name of it?
No, sir, I don't.
Okay.
That's something, Richard, that has escaped me. I never, ever recall fire bases being named. I know there was a lot of them that were, and maybe the fire bases had a name, and I didn't know them. You know, we were never told. I mean, you know. But anyway, we were taken back to this fire base, and we were asked if there was anybody that needed any medical attention, you know, to get on this particular chopper. I had a piece of shrapnel about the size of, about as big around as my thumb and about half inch long in the back of my leg. And I got on this chopper to go down to wherever they was going to take us to have this thing cut out of my leg. That evening, there was someone from division came into that fire base and gave out bronze stars to the guys that was left up there on the hill or on, at the fire base. The guys that went to have medical attention did not receive this. And I was, you know, and I didn't know this, see, Richard, until the last two or three years, see. And I was in contact or have been in contact with our company commander at the time, and I asked him about this. And, of course, he said there wasn't anything that could be done, you know, with it now, which, you know, I mean, I understand. I mean, it'd been nice to have had that award, but I was thankful I got out of there with my life.
Yes, sir.
You know?
Yes, sir.
Anyway, I went back to a place in Khantoum, Richard, and had this medal or the shrapnel cut out of my leg.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there probably 2 or 3 days, and they brought us or took us back to our companies. And from there on, Richard, I remember us being brought back into base camp, which was Camp Inari,
mm-hmm.
and we were resupplied. I'm talking about our equipment.
Mm-hmm.
We were also given new people. I mean, you know, we had to have a new company practically made up.
Yes, sir.
And from this point on, Richard, it really gets kind of fuzzy with me, because I lost touch, I guess, with things after that battle. After we lost so many guys, I was just to the point where I didn't give a shit one way or the other,
mm-hmm.
you know. And of course, this would have been in April,
mm-hmm.
and in May and June, I think we just kind of run patrols, you know, and around the Central Highlands there.
Right.
I remember I remember working out of a fire support base, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't know the name.
Mm-hmm.
And I may be getting a little behind or ahead. I'm not sure where this particular sequence that I'm getting ready to tell you about, Richard. I'm not sure where this what month this took place.
Okay. Go ahead.
I remember. And it runs in my mind, Richard, it might have been let me think here, Richard, just a minute.
Okay, take your time.
So. Yeah, I'm not real sure, Richard, of the month,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not real certain. I was trying to think who our captain was at that time. But anyway, I guess to make a long story short.
Well, do you remember if it was before or after Chumor?
That's what I can't remember,
okay.
Richard. I'm thinking it was. Let's see. I'm thinking, Richard, it was. I'm thinking it was after.
Okay.
But boy, I'll tell you, there it's you know, I like I said, it gets kind of fuzzy.
Right.
But anyway, I remember us as a company being moved,
mm-hmm.
and we had a gentleman with us. His name was Mixon. I don't recall. Yes, I do too. His name was Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Mixon. And I remember him. He was getting ready to leave the company. He was getting ready to come back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the guy I was telling you about initially in the interview where I went in. And he was kind of the, you know, the boss, so to speak, you know, and he said, you know, he said, if you screw up, hey, I'm going to send your ass to Long Beach Jail,
yes,
you know.
Sir.
And, but I had a lot of respect for this man.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when we was walking up to this particular area,
mm-hmm.
he says to me, he comes up and he's getting ready to leave the field, and he puts his arms around me and gives me a hug, and he said, Hale, he said, you watch your ass. He said, Charlie's up there, you know.
Right.
Well, they were walking 105 howitzers in up on the sides of us,
mm-hmm.
To keep them off of us until we got to this particular location, mm-hmm. to get dug in.
Right.
And I remember we all getting our foxholes dug that night, and or as best we could.
Right.
In fact, they called Snoopy, and he had several different names. He was called Snoopy. He was called Puff the Magic Dragon. What it was a C-47 gunship.
Right. Okay.
And they dropped flares, and they also shot around our perimeter,
mm-hmm.
you know, until we could halfway get dug in and get acclimated to the area.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was quiet until about 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I happened to be on watch,
mm-hmm.
and they started mortaring us.
Okay.
And of course, you hear, you know, a mortar has a very distinct sound to it. And, you know, when I heard that thud,
mm-hmm.
well, I knew what it was, you know. And, of course, you know, you yell and say, hey, you know, we're incoming, you know, and everything. Mm-hmm. Everybody scrambled trying to get into a hole. And I don't know how long this mortar barrage took place, Richard. It seemed like an eternity.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a guessing it might have been 30 minutes.
Okay.
And I did not get into a hole. The hole we was in, or hole I started in, was full,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't get in, and I was laying on top of the ground, and I remember praying, you know, saying, oh, God, you know, don't let one of those mortar rounds hit me in the back, you
right.
know.
Right.
And after that, you know, they kind of left the area or something. I don't know where they went. We never seen them again, never heard from them.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of left, and we kind of went on about our merry way.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably in June, or no, it was July, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
I went on R&R.
Okay.
And I kind of forgot about Vietnam for a few days. I went to Sydney, Australia.
Okay.
I remember having, you know, a good time down there, and I remember coming back, and that was probably one of the hardest things I ever done, was coming back to that godforsaken place.
Right.
Knowing what I'd been through, and I thought, you know, here I've got... Well, it'd been July, August, September, October. I had 5 more months to go before I could come home.
Right.
And, you know, I went down to Australia, come back, and I spent, you know, maybe a day. I'm not sure where we was in Benoit or where we was at, Richard, but anyway, they flew us back north to Pleiku and took us back into the company,
mm-hmm.
Base camp,
mm-hmm.
and from there they took us back out into the field.
Can I ask you what did you do in Australia on your R&R? Did you go by yourself, or were you with a couple of guys from your company?
No, I actually went by myself, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up meeting a couple guys. One was from the Army. One was from the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of buddied together,
mm-hmm.
you know. And basically, I mean, it was, I mean, if you really want to know the honest to God's truth, it was one big drunk.
Okay.
That's, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that, I mean, that's putting it honest.
Okay. Okay. So you guys just basically drink and... Did you go out to bars, or were you...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
anything else about that R&R that you remember or anything significant?
Oh, I remember the country, you know, Richard, as being, you know, a beautiful part of the country. We was in Sydney. I remember going to the zoo.
Okay.
And, you know, I remember the Opera House, you know.
Right.
I remember that. I remembered the bay. And I something that really struck me when I got down there, when I got off the plane and stepped into the airport, how damn cold it was.
Was this during their winter time, I guess?
Yes, it was during their winter.
Okay.
But, I mean, really, it wasn't, I mean, it was 70 degrees.
Right.
But I was freezing to death, Richard, because I'd come from 110, 115 degree heat.
Right.
You know, and, man, I mean, I was cold, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I remember having a good time and basically, for the most part, enjoying myself as much as I could, you know. I guess if you consider being drunk all the time, enjoying yourself, I guess that's, you know, not as good as it's going to get.
Right. How did you feel at this point, you know, psychologically and emotionally? You know, you've been through a lot of really bad experiences. Were you able to get away and you know, really reflect or relax to try to not think about what had happened, or did you?
Well, I felt bad, Richard, about leaving the guys.
Mm-hmm.
I felt guilty. Mm-hmm. Leaving them. I mean, not that I could have been a savior to any of them.
Right.
I just felt bad, and I spent a lot of time thinking about the guys, what was going on, what they were doing, where they were at,
mm-hmm.
This, that, and the other. Reflecting back just a little bit, Richard, on Chew Moore, I think this is probably common with a lot of combat veterans.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel guilty. And I say that because it's a survivor guilt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've often asked myself, you know, why wasn't I, you know, one of the ones that was killed up there?
Right.
I don't know. You know, the only thing that I can come up with, you know, is God had a different plan for me than he had for some, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. That's the only thing I can come up with, Richard. I mean, I had, I think I told you early on in the interview that I had a mother that wasn't capable of taking care of me.
Yes, sir.
And I think the good Lord spared my life to take care of her, you know, in her last years.
Right.
As best I could. And, of course, I feel guilty of that, you know, from that experience with her.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you go through what I went through at Chew Moore, you have a survivor guilt.
Right.
And it weighs on you.
What have you done to alleviate that?
Well,
up until
20 years ago, Richard, 21 years ago, I hadn't done anything.
Okay.
I went through a divorce that was nasty.
Mm-hmm.
I had two boys by that first marriage.
Mm-hmm.
After that divorce, I pretty much turned back to drinking. Until I met my current wife, she had lost her husband to Hodgkin's disease that was due to Agent Orange exposure. He passed away in 78, and I was divorced at that time. I did not know this lady. I knew her husband. I worked with him, but I did not know her.
Right.
And I met her in 1980.
Okay.
And she had two little girls by this gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
We were married in March of 81. And the only way that this woman would take me to be her spouse was that I attended church.
Okay.
And that I went to church with her and the kids. And one thing led to another, and I ended up getting saved.
Okay.
And I think Richard, had it not been for her and probably not been for the good Lord, I probably wouldn't be here today.
Okay.
Also, I have, in the last year to year and a half, I have gotten counseling for this PTSD,
mm-hmm.
and it has helped immensely.
That's very good.
And I'll tell you what, it was good for me, Richard. It really was. I mean, you know, I've heard, I've talked to a lot of guys that say, well, you know, that's a bunch of malarkey. You know, it doesn't
right.
work. Well,
right.
I'm here to tell you, it does work. You know,
good.
And you know, it's not been without some. Bad nights.
Mm-hmm.
I have I've had bad dreams and still continue to have some, not as frequent as I used to have them.
Mm-hmm.
My temper is somewhat better than it used to be,
mm-hmm.
and I was never one, Richard, to. A lot of people take it out on their wife and kids. I never ever done that.
Okay.
I always found a different outlet for my anger.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose most of that was turning to the bottle,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
And that's another thing, Richard. I think where the Vietnam veteran was wronged was we were brought back into this country and turned loose back into society as we know it. And we weren't debriefed.
Right.
You know, and therefore when you turn a man loose into a civilization and he's come from a combat unit, It's very tough to him to adjust.
I can imagine.
You know, I was fortunate in that I didn't see a lot of. I mean, I've seen people demonstrating, you know, against the war. You know, I was never one. I wasn't spit upon, but I always felt looked down upon
mm-hmm.
by. By people that didn't go to the service, or by people that went to school to keep from going to the service,
mm-hmm.
Things like this. I mean, and, you know, I get to thinking, Richard, you know, hey, I done my job. I mean, I was called, you know, to do this. And I done it. Why are they looking down upon me?
Right.
You know.
Right.
I'm not saying that Vietnam was right, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was right at the time, up until maybe 1969, possibly 1970.
Okay.
After that, I thought it was time to either shit or get off the pot.
Right.
I mean, you know, you either go in and you do the job
right.
and get out, or, you know, don't do it.
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And I also feel like, I mean, I'm not, and I don't want to step on anybody's toes, and I told you that from the beginning.
Yes, sir.
I felt like, Richard, and I felt like this, that there was a lot of big people in government that made money, and I call it blood money, is what I call it, and I personally think Lyndon Johnson was one of them.
Okay.
Now that's my opinion, and I do know another gentleman that lives in this little village that I live in, and he told me that this guy happened to be with the 25th Infantry Division, and he's seen this with his own eyes. He said he's seen a. Now, where this was at, I'm not sure where it was. Was it Coochie or where it was at? He's seen this, but they had pallets of lumber that had Lady Bird Johnson Construction Company on there, you know.
Really?
Hey, you know, Richard, you don't do that. I mean, you know, my God, you got guys over dying every day, you know, for what we thought was... trying to deter communism, you know, and then you got people back in this country that's making money off of that. I don't think so, you know. But you know, by the same token, you had civilian contractors over there.
Right.
So I mean, you know, you can't. I mean, they were doing the same thing.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But just. You know, things like that. And Richard, let's see. Getting back, I guess, to July, coming back into country. I felt like it was useless. I thought, you know, what in the heck are we doing over here, you know? I mean, we tried to take Chumor and various other places. I mean, when I say various other places, I'm not talking about our company. I'm talking about, you know, all these other places, you know, that took a beating. You know, and why did we do it? I mean, what were we accomplishing?
Right.
You know, to me, Richard, the Vietnamese... I did not particularly have I didn't particularly care for the Vietnamese, and they never. It's not that they done anything to me, Richard.
Right.
It's what I saw, and by that I mean I felt like we were fighting their battles.
Okay.
We'd go into town, whether it be Pleiku or Kontum or any of these towns.
Sorry, sir, you're breaking up again.
Oh, okay. I don't know why, Richard. I'm on the phone.
Okay.
But anyway, we would go into these towns, and they were sitting on the streets selling our clothing and our boots, and the stuff that we had on, Richard, was falling off of us, and we couldn't get stuff like that. And it was on the black market being sold.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I just never could understand why that went on. Now, they had a people up in the Central Highlands, and I'm sure you've probably heard of, called the Mountain Yards.
Yes, sir.
I had a lot of respect for them people. They were good people. They were good fighters. And they helped the Americans immensely.
When you say good fighters, what do you mean?
I'm talking about they wouldn't leave you.
Okay.
If you was caught in a firefight, they would not leave you by yourself. They would stay with you if they had to die.
Okay, and Arvin would not.
That's correct. That's the experience that I had with them, Richard.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not saying that's with all of them.
Right.
But I'm just saying that's the experience that I had with them.
How much contact did you have with the Monyards?
Not, I won't say a lot, Richard, but we did have some. And the same with the Arvins. We didn't have a lot of contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
We worked with them a little bit. And, you know, as far as I was concerned, they just, I don't know, they wanted us to do it for them.
Right.
You know. But I had been through several of the Mountain Yard villages, Richard, and for the most part, I mean, those people were helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they would help you if they could. And probably knowing that they were helping us, they were going to get retaliated against.
Right.
You know, by maybe their village being burned or somebody being killed in the village or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I also know, Richard, that I think it's North Carolina, out around Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm.
They have a big contingent of Mountain Yard people.
Yes, sir, that's correct. One of the largest populations in the United States is located there in southeastern North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
How would you rate, going back to your flying back in country, were you contemplating this overall policy of the United States coming back in country? I mean, were you rethinking these thoughts, these deep thoughts?
I won't say I was. I really was really thinking about them real, real hard, Richard, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I got to thinking about this after I came home.
Okay.
You know. So I guess I give it some thought, but I didn't give it a lot of thought.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And I guess basically, Richard, when I got back in country in July, my main concern was to hey, I'd survived 7 months.
Right.
I'm going to get my ass out of here,
right.
You know, one way or the other, you know.
Right.
And, you know.
Let me ask you a question about that particular subject. How do you reconcile this natural feeling that you described of trying to stay alive in a hostile environment with trying to, you know, serve your buddies there and your platoon and your company?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying, Richard.
Like, you have a desire to stay alive. Did that mean when you were, you know, when you went back in country and you're involved in any kind of firefight or any kind of dangerous situation?
Well, I can remember, you know, being out on patrols and stuff, you know, setting up ambushes, this kind of thing.
Right.
As far as us being in any real heavy contact, Richard, after July, I don't recall that.
Okay. I guess what I'm asking is, you know, when you're in that contact with the enemy and you're thinking, you know, I want to stay alive, you know, I don't want to die, but you also want to be there for your fellow soldier right there beside you, these guys that you know.
Right.
How do you reconcile those two thoughts? I mean, do you duck more than you usually would or hide more than you usually would? Or you know what I'm asking?
Yes, I know what you're saying.
Okay.
I think a person has a tendency, Richard, to kind of look out after number one.
Right.
First, you know. And then if you got somebody that needs help, yeah, you're going to help him. I mean, that's something that's hard. It's very hard for me to describe.
Right.
I know I had a real good friend. I think he was from South Carolina. I think that's where Sam was from. And I think, Richard, had it really, really got down to the nitty-gritty, if he'd have needed me, if I'd have had to expose myself, yeah, I'd have done it.
Okay.
I really think I would have. If that answers your question, I'm not trying to skirt the issue. I just... I'm just trying to answer it the best I know.
Yes, sir. It does answer the question. And also, there's a general feeling that in Vietnam, and this might be true in other wars as well, that's certainly been said about other wars, is that the soldier on the ground, his first priority is to his men beside him and not overall to the country or to the policy or to the big battle. It's really to the people right there in the foxhole with you.
Right.
Is that true?
I think it was true for the most part, Richard, over there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, I'm saying this and probably shouldn't say it. I think it was that way through probably 64, 65, 66, 67, mm-hmm. 68.
Mm-hmm.
After 68, from things that I've read, I don't know if that was true.
Okay. Meaning after 68, they were serving more to stay alive, or
I think it was more of maybe they didn't go out on a patrol that they should have went out on.
Okay.
Or they were told to go to a certain area and they went halfway to it. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And I don't know, Richard. I have seen pictures and I've read articles. And the reason I say that is because when I was over there in 67, 68, we were required, even though we were in the field and we had horrible living conditions,
mm-hmm.
we were required to be kept shaven and cleaned up.
Okay.
I mean, regardless of whether, you know, it was in the field or where we was at, we were required to at least shave.
Okay.
And keep our hair. I mean, you know, we cut each other's hair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And but the pictures and stuff that I've seen after 68,
mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys had, you know, long hair and they done stuff that, my God, I mean, you know, our company was, that would never have happened. You know.
Okay.
So I don't know whether, you know, they got lax, you know, with the guys over there or just what happened, Richard. I just really don't know.
Okay.
Let me insert a little something here, Richard.
Sure.
I truly believe, and I believe this from the bottom of my heart, that war was winnable.
Okay.
I don't think they wanted us to win that war.
Who's they?
I'm talking about our government.
Okay. Why do you think that?
Why?
Yes, sir.
Well, when you are put in harm's way of a hill,
mm-hmm.
and you sacrifice men's lives, and you may possibly take that hill, and 3 days later you walk off of it,
mm-hmm.
and leave it and turn it back over to Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's the point?
Right.
You know, but I do think I think we had them on the ropes, Richard. They
okay.
just wouldn't. They just wouldn't. We weren't allowed to finish it.
What do you think the United States could have done differently to finish it?
What do I think they could have done?
Yes, sir.
Let me think here just a minute, Richard.
Sure, of course.
I think we could have went in and done a number on North Vietnam. I mean, put them completely out of commission.
Okay.
You know. Well, we're getting a lot of static, Richard.
Yes, we are.
I don't know, that may be my phone. Let me switch phones here just a second, Richard.
Okay.
I think personally, Richard, that if they'd have went in and bombed the hell out of North Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
I'm talking about, I mean, leveled it.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying using atomic weapons. I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying put them to their knees, you
right.
know.
Instead of the piecemeal and
yes.
kind of escalated
yes.
bombing.
Yes. And, you know, from things that I have read, and I can't tell you the name of the
the big general that that was over North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I have read, that when he was at the peace table in Paris,
mm-hmm.
he made the comment, supposedly, that he said, "We can't beat you guys on a battlefield, but we'll beat you in propaganda."
Right.
And that's exactly what they done.
Right.
You know, and I mean, he admitted right there that you know, that they couldn't beat us.
Right.
I mean, that was proven, you know, time and time again over there.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel like, Richard, that you know, we could have won that war. I don't think it was meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
And
from the very beginning, or at some point in between.
I think in the beginning, Richard, I think they had they had good intentions.
Okay.
I really do. I think it escalated so fast that they had to put the GIs over there in order to try to stop the move of communism.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one thing led to another, and it got to the place where we were doing it, the most of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, instead of letting the Harvin do it. And I don't know, Richard. I guess when I think of the Vietnamese, I think of a people that are happy
mm-hmm.
with that way of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't. I mean, in my opinion, you can't take and push capitalism off onto people that know anything else but communism.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I've got a lot of mixed feelings about you know, what we tried to do over there. I think we had good intentions to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when the people back home weren't given a good reason why we were there
mm-hmm.
and what we were trying to accomplish,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, you've seen it on TV every night, I mean, just day in and day out,
mm-hmm.
I think it hardened the... I think it hardened our people, Richard, as far as the support for the war went.
Right.
And people got fed up with it and said, "Hey, you know, let's get out, forget it, you
mm-hmm.
know, and let it go." You know.
How much did those anti-war protests affect you while you were over there in the field? Did you know about them?
I personally did not, Richard.
Okay.
No, I personally did not.
Okay. Did you guys have access to the news and what was happening around the world or back in the United States while you were there?
I had, I recall very little of that, Richard. I don't recall. The only thing I recall, Richard, we had what we called Armed Forces Radio.
Okay.
And basically that consisted of listening to the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday night. Of course, that tells you, you know, we're kind of rednecking it, I guess. But, you know, basically, Richard, I did not, I just don't recall having access to any news
mm-hmm.
of what was going on back home and these demonstrators and stuff. I just mm-hmm. don't recall that. And, Richard, I would like to terminate this right now.
Okay.
And we'll pick it up again, and I feel like I've kind of spun my wheels with you.
Okay.
But you know, maybe I've helped some, and you want to set a. Let's see now, Richard. Let me think here just a minute.
Let me sign off here real quick, sir.
No problem.
This is Richard Verone, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Elmer Hale. It is December 9th, 2002, approximately 9:50 a.m. And I'm in Lubbock, Texas. And, Mr. Hale, you are where again?
Flat Rock, Illinois.
Flat Rock, Illinois. That's right. Okay, sir, we left off. You had been discussing overall American policy, and I wanted to follow up with your comments on what was happening on the ground in general. And I wonder if you could discuss some of your tactics in the field, your unit's tactics. And we discussed some of this previously, but I wanted to ask you specifically about, did you get enough support from artillery and then from the medevac units and things like that while you were in the field?
Personally, Richard, I feel that we did not get enough support from our artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that, the battle that we had gone through at Chumore, I felt was very inadequate. I think our commanders back in where they were located, which was not in the general area, of course. I think they felt like that, you know, we could take that hill by ourselves, you know. And personally, that's just not the way you do things in combat. In fact, I had a gentleman with us. His name was Sergeant Buck. He was from state of Maine. He had gone through Korea, through Pusan, and he made the comment to me the day before he was killed. He said, had that hill been in Korea, it'd been leveled. I mean, there wouldn't have been nothing on it, you know. And we never got that kind of artillery support.
Who would make the call there to get that artillery coming in?
Well, our captains were the ones that actually made the calls, or the lieutenants, to get the artillery. But it wasn't, ultimately, it wasn't in their hands to, you know, to really get it to us, because that call came from, you know, higher ups in our division. And I know from being there that we just did not get that artillery support.
Was that in general, or was that specifically with Chumore?
I think that was specifically with Chumore. I didn't really have any problems before that or after that, Richard, as far as, you know, griping about the artillery support. I don't know why we didn't get it there. I just felt like it was very, very inadequate. I mean, we just did not get that support that we needed.
Okay. How about the medevac dust-off teams? Were they functional?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I had the utmost regard for the dust-offs. I've seen those guys, and I mean, they were super.
Mm-hmm.
They were super.
I've interviewed a number of pilots and asked them the question, how did you get in, how could you overcome the fear or deal with the intensity of fire when you would land in a hot LZ to evacuate? And they said, well, it's just our job.
Yeah, right.
And did you see them just do something like this, come into a hot LZ?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I specifically seen this, well, at Chumore as well as Khantoum in the Tet Offensive in 68, and I would love to get a hold of the gentleman that had the dust off that came into Khantoum. He went by the call sign Galloping Ghost, and we had called for a dust off because we had several wounded, and we told him it was hot, you know. And he asked us, you know, specifically what direction it was coming from and all this, you know, and we told him, and he said, I'm coming in, and he said, when them skids hit the ground, he said, you make sure you got them people loaded, and I'm going, you know. And like I said, I had lots and lots of respect for them people, because they I mean, it was their job, but it took some bravery and you know, whatever on their part to come in and help us guys.
Mm-hmm.
I really respected those people.
How much air support did you get? Did you feel like it was adequate or not?
For the most part, it was, Richard. What I had a problem with on a couple occasions, we would call for air support, and there just wasn't enough air support to go around. Because we called, we would call, and they'd say, well, you know, they're busy up north, or they're busy down here in the Delta or somewhere, you know, they couldn't get to us. Well, you know, dad burn it. You know, I mean, when you need help, you need help. You can't say, well, you know, we're going to sit back here on our rumps and for 30 minutes and wait. You know, sometimes it's a situation where you're in dire need and you need that air support. Mm-hmm. You know, and I feel like for the most part we didn't have a problem, but on two or three occasions, yes, we did. We needed it and we didn't get it.
Mr. Hale, could you describe your general impressions of the enemy? Both the NVA regulars and the BC?
I thought that the NVA were very well trained. They were motivated. I don't know what kept them motivated for no more than they had. I never understood that. They were very determined. They were good fighters. Overall, I would say they were very good. In what they faced from us, Richard, such as the artillery and the strafing and the air support and the tanks and stuff, we never, we never faced anything like that from their side. But they had years and years and years to prepare for this, too. So, you know, I'd say overall they were very good at what they done. I will say this, I think, and this is my own opinion, I think if they had you outnumbered, they were more willing to fight. If they didn't have you outnumbered, they would hit and run. And this was especially, so with the VC. You know, they were kind of a ragtag outfit, but, you know, they would stand and fight if they had you outnumbered.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the weaknesses were of the NVA?
Now, you talking about, Richard, specifically the soldier?
Mm-hmm.
Or, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Or the soldier or the tactics or
mm-hmm.
just whatever you think.
I think the NVA soldier I'd say very good, Richard. I mean, you know, and I think their tactics was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, like I said, that was their home turf.
Right.
You know, they knew that country and they knew that jungle and everything, whereas the American soldier didn't know that country well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about the best I can describe them, Richard. I think they had good equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Especially their rifles and stuff that they carried, the AK.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very fine weapon and still is today.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the guys didn't all carry AKs. Some of them carried SKSs that were manufactured in China.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, Richard, I don't know that the NVA actually had a weakness. I mean, I just really never seen that, you know.
On the battlefield, say, after a firefighter, after a battle, there's been a lot written about the activities of both sides, policing up their wounded, and how that went about. Did you ever witness the enemy or hear about the enemy executing American wounded on the battlefield before they could be rescued or taken back to the American perimeter?
Excuse me, Richard. I didn't specifically see this, although at Chumore, you know, I think I might have mentioned we had left a couple guys up there, and they, I don't know that they executed them because I think they were dead before, you know, they ever hit the ground, really. I did hear of some mutilations that went on from their side as well as ours. I remember, excuse me just a minute, Richard. talking to a boy in Fort Benning, Georgia, who had, now he wasn't in our company, he was in our division, and he had gone out on a patrol, him and four or five other guys, and he was the only one that survived that. And they had shot him, left him for dead, and they had also bayoneted him and cut a couple of his fingers off where he had a ring or something on, you know, this kind of thing. And we had a couple guys in our company that would take gold teeth and stuff, you know, from the NVA or VC or whatever. I personally never participated in that kind of stuff. That wasn't my thing. I did, and I'm not patting myself on the back, Richard. I don't want you to think that I am, because I'm not. In the Tet Offensive in 68, I think it might have been to the east of Khantoum, we were kind of going up, kind of cleaning up and mopping up an area, and there was a NVA or V. Well, let's see, this guy might have been NVA. I think he was NVA, and he was wounded on the ground, you know, and one of our guys was gonna shoot him. And I stepped in and said, no, you know, you ain't going to do this, you know. And maybe that was right, maybe it was wrong, I don't know. But I couldn't stand by and want to see one of our guys go ahead and kill this guy for no apparent reason. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he wasn't being threatened. This guy was a threat to nobody. He was wounded, wasn't going to do anything. But yes, it went on and went on both sides.
Okay. You mentioned earlier the weapons used by the NVA and the VC. What kind of weapons did you carry personally?
Well, I started out carrying the M16, mm-hmm. and I also carried a 45 automatic mm-hmm. pistol,
okay.
and I also carried the M79 grenade launcher, and then I went back to the M16 as when I became a RTO, which was radio telephone operator.
How do those weapons function?
Overall, the M16 was good mm-hmm. if you kept it clean. You had to keep it immaculate in order for it to operate. The M79 grenade launcher was pretty much foolproof, Richard. I mean, it kind of loaded, broke down like a shotgun, and there really wasn't a whole lot to it. You know, I've seen a lot of problems with the M16.
Okay. Which one was your favorite to carry?
Of those two weapons?
Well, the ones that you carried while you were
in. Okay. Well, it's just really hard to say, Richard. I would say, I don't know, I suppose the M16 would be my favorite, especially if it was in close quarter combat. Of course, the M79 was made to launch a grenade, you know, for several hundred meters or whatever. But overall, I think the M16 was probably the favorite.
Okay. Was there any weapon that you did not have that you wish you did have?
Not that I can think of, Richard, off the top of my head.
Okay.
I do think this, Richard. I think there were better weapons out there. Now, I'm talking about maybe not on our market, but on, Switzerland, somewhere like that. I think there were better weapons out there, but, overall, the M16 functioned fairly well.
Okay. Could you describe, basically, when your unit would set up for the night, how would you set up a defensive perimeter?
We would set up a defensive perimeter in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
We would dig bunkers, and sometimes those bunkers would be big enough for two people, sometimes four people.
How big was the circle in diameter, would you say?
Oh, my. I think it depended on how many men we had, Richard, at the time. I would say it would cover, this is just my opinion now, Richard. I really don't know. I'm saying a good half acre.
Okay.
And at night, of course, we would dig the holes, and then we'd have to cut the timber to put on top of them and fill the sandbags. And then at night, we would put out LPs. And the LPs would go out in four-man teams, and we would put four of them out, and one to each corner. And they would set up trip flares and stuff at night, and this was to kind of give the perimeter a little warning, you know, that we had movement or we had company that night. And then usually our CP was set up in the middle of the circle, and we usually kept one man awake on the LPs at all times, tried to, and then we usually kept one man awake on each bunker, and this was something, Richard, that was very, very hard to do, because when you put in as many hours as we put in over there in a day's time, naturally people were tired.
Of course.
And you would fall asleep, or things would seem like they were moving, you know, in the jungle. I'm sure you probably heard this before, but, you know, you'd be sitting on a bunker and you'd think you'd have movement out in front of you when really it was your mind, you know, playing little games with you, you know. But that's basically how we set up. And then at night, when we did set up like that, we would usually have our CO would call in, or our FO, our forward observer, would call in and have artillery plotted around us, you know, in case we did get into something. But basically, that's about, how we set up, Richard, at night.
Okay. How was it determined who would actually go out on the LP and who would stay in?
They were rotated.
Okay. Where did you prefer to be?
I preferred to be back in the perimeter. Because you just didn't have that much warning, Richard, if you were out on the LP. I mean, you know, you were out maybe 100 meters in front of the perimeter. And by the time those trip flares went off, if you had company during the night, by the time those trip flares went off, it was almost too late,
right.
You know. So I preferred to be back in the perimeter. That's not the way it always worked, but, you know, you had to do what you had to do.
Right. What was it like at nighttime there?
Let's see, Richard, let me think just a second. It was eerie. You had all kinds of animals to contend with. For the most part, though, they didn't really bother us. And I suppose they could have, you know, like the tigers and the snakes and stuff. But for the most part, we didn't have a lot of problem with them. The mosquitoes was horrendous. Scorpions, this kind of stuff.
What kind of animals did you see?
I never seen the animal itself, Richard. I've seen elephant tracks. Seen a lot of snakes, scorpions, rats. They had rats over there, Richard, big as cats.
That's what I've heard.
They were very, very huge. there was a little deer that they had over there, Richard, and I remember telling my wife here, it's been a few years ago, National Geographic had gone over there and claims that they had found this deer that was extinct, you know, supposedly extinct. Had a picture of it, and I told Sharon, I said, that animal's not extinct. I've seen it when I was over in Vietnam, you know. But it was a very, very little thing. It was probably the size of about the size of a half-grown dog, you know, and very, very fast. we've seen turtles, big turtles in these rivers and stuff over there. I never really seen the tigers, you know, Richard. I mean, we've seen tracks and stuff of them, and I've seen pictures of where they, you know, people had shot them or whatever, you know. Monkeys, seen a lot of monkeys, a lot of monkeys. I remember a little experience that I had over with the monkeys, Richard.
Tell me about it.
Oh, I'll tell you what, it was scary, but afterwards it was funny. I had been sent out by myself probably 100 yards, 75 to 100 yards outside of our perimeter, and I was sitting beside this this big tree. And I heard a noise, excuse me, Richard, and I had a radio with me, and I called in and told him, I said, I think we've got movement, you know. Well, the CO come on, you know, and he said, just stay where you're at, you know, and he said, keep an eye on it, keep your ears open, your eyes open, and pretty soon I could hear it out. You know, I heard it out in front of me first, and I heard it over to the side, and I heard it over to the right side and the left side, and I thought, man, you know. I thought I was getting surrounded. See, I thought, man, them suckers know where I'm at. They're gonna capture me or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon this movement would quit, and it'd be quiet for a little bit, and then pretty soon start up again. And I thought, man, you know, I'd begin to get a little shaky. And pretty soon it stopped again. And I still hadn't detected what they were. And pretty soon it started up again, and I seen them. They were moving through the treetops, Richard. I mean, just like a colony of them, you know, or whatever. And there was lots of them. And I finally called in and told them. I said, it's just, you know, just a bunch of monkeys, you know. And they would be drawn, these monkeys would, to an area where we were at. And I think they may have associated that with food, mm-hmm. you know, or something. I really don't know. But and we had one that followed us for probably a couple miles.
Really?
You know. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he'd follow the company, you know. And pretty soon, why, he disappeared. I don't know where he went back, you know, to his territory or where. But that was kind of funny at the end of it. But it wasn't funny in the beginning.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any problems with people getting bitten by snakes?
To my knowledge, Richard, we never had anyone bitten. Mm-hmm. We had a sergeant that had he slept in a hammock and most of us guys slept on the ground. And we were in this one area, and I can't tell you exactly where it was at, Richard. We had been clearing a field of fire, and the snakes were really bad in this area. And I personally had been out there helping clear this field of fire, and one of the guys hollered at me, and this snake was getting ready to strike the back of my leg, and he hit it with a machete and killed it.
Wow.
And I was that close, and I asked the medic, I said, is that a poisonous snake? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, if that snake had bit you, you'd never made it out of here, you know. But anyway, this Sergeant Mixon, when we got through clearing this field of fire, he went back up and laid down his hammock. And, I mean, he hadn't been in there 5 seconds, and he jumped out and started cussing and ranting and raving, you know, and said, there's something in that hammock, you know. And we raised there were two layers of that thing, and we opened those layers up, and there that thing was. I mean, it was a poisonous snake, you know, had gotten in there, and they were real thick in that area. But I never really heard of anybody in our outfit getting bit, Richard, by snakes. I just never, you know, I'm not saying it didn't happen. I just don't recall.
Right. Going back to your description of the nighttime, was it easy to sleep? I mean, I know that depended on the situation. And
was it easy to what, Richard?
To sleep.
To sleep?
Yes, sir.
Not really. In fact, like I said, I mean, you know, most of the time you were so wore out, you did sleep, but it wasn't a fitful sleep. Of course, it was always hot. Most of the time it was hot. Now, up in the Central Highlands, Richard, at night it did cool off some. In fact, I've seen where, you know, I've seen it where it was so cool that you had to have two poncho liners to keep warm. For the most part, I think, Richard, most of the guys were so tired that they did sleep some, but you always had bugs to contend with, you know, and sweat, and the miserable conditions of not being able to bathe every day, and you know, not having a clean change of clothes every day or every other day. But sometimes it was tough, and at other times it wasn't, Richard. I know I slept better when we were back in base camp, which was very few times. But sleep kind of escaped you most of the time.
Okay. Did you feel like you had enough supplies in the field?
Not really.
What were you lacking?
Well, for one thing, Richard, we didn't have the our boots would get in very, very bad shape before we could ever get any, and sometimes, you know, they were used stuff. Our clothes would almost be in shreds before we got clean clothes and stuff out to us. Water. I won't say it was in short supply, but there was times when we could have used water we didn't have. Of course, our company or our outfit lived off of sea rations. We were lucky to get a hot meal once a week, and most of the time it wasn't fit to eat, you know. But there was things, I think, Richard, you know, those little things like that. And if you went into town, you'd see this stuff being sold on the black market, which, you know, irritated the shit out of me, you know, because there was guys out there that needed boots and socks and this kind of stuff that sometimes we could get it and sometimes we couldn't. And it was being sold on the black market. You know, it was free to anybody. I mean, you know, if you had the money, you could get it. Well, you know, the soldier in the field needed it, but he couldn't get it.
Right. And you end up having to purchase with your money American supplies that were supposed to be for you.
Well, I wouldn't say that, Richard, because I never purchased anything as far as our clothing and stuff went. No, I never really purchased anything like that, but it was there if you wanted to buy it,
right.
You know. And I was always one to say to hell with it. If they can't furnish it, then I'll go without,
mm-hmm.
You know. And that's what I, you know, that's basically what we done. Trying to think, but basically, I don't know, Richard. I think we had, I mean, it was adequate, but it could have been better, you know. We did get supplied with what we called a CP. It was a big pack, big box, and it had candy in it, and it had cigarettes and toilet tissue and just, you know, a little bit of everything, you know. And we kind of divided that up, and I think that pretty much come once a week or once every 2 weeks.
Okay.
And we'd get a little ration of beer. You know, it didn't amount to a whole lot. And, of course, it was hot, you know, and there's nothing worse than a hot beer.
Did you see any excessive alcohol use or drug use?
Yes. I didn't really see any excessive alcohol use, Richard, because, like I said, we just got, you know, rationed. And when it was gone, you know. But now the drug use was very prevalent.
Could you describe that?
We had several guys in our company, Richard, that was on drugs, and they would buy this stuff. Now, where they bought it at, I don't know. I suppose they bought it off the villages and stuff like this. And when they were in town, that stuff was like the women. I mean, you know, the women was cheap. The drugs was cheap. I remember we had a guy with us, and I cannot tell you his name. I guess it really doesn't make any difference. But this guy was in the company when I went in November of 67, and he was still with the company in November of 68 when I came back to the States. And this guy was high all the time. And I seen this guy down in Pleiku before I came back, or before I flew out of there to Cameron Bay. And he was downtown Pleiku, and there was five or six MPs, Richard, that was trying to load him into a deuce and a half, and they had beat him with those nightsticks, and his head was swollen up the size of a basketball. I mean, they had really worked him, and he was still on his feet. I mean, but the drugs were real bad over there. They really were. And I think it probably got worse after I left there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is me talking, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
I think personally, guys that done drugs done it to escape reality. You know, I wanted to know what was going on around me, you know. And I felt like the sharper I was, the better off I was, you know. But the drugs were getting bad.
Was that looked down upon by the other members of your platoon or company, the guys who were using the drugs?
Well, I feel like it was, Richard. I feel like that it was, yes.
Did you ever know of any officers who were using?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Did you ever witness any tension between the draftees and the lifers?
No, not really, Richard. I didn't.
Okay.
Now, what I did witness was some tension between the people out in the field,
mm-hmm.
versus the people that stayed back in base camp and had jobs back there to do. Mm-hmm. I never, you know, really had anything, any animosity toward these people, because I felt like that was their job and I had my job.
Right.
You know, although I might not have liked it, it was still something that I had to do, and their job consisted of, you know, maybe being back on a typewriter or in resupply or whatever the case was. Now, I did see a lot of fights and stuff over that. But basically, I never seen anything out of the way of the people that were lifers versus the draftees. And I think for the most part, Richard, now speaking for myself, for the most part, I think we had a pretty good relationship with those people that were lifers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did anyway.
Right.
You know.
Right. Did you ever hear any talk of fracking?
I heard some scuttlebutt about it, yes. Mm-hmm. But I never ever witnessed anything that actually took place. You know, I knew a lot of guys that, you know, would get pissed off at the officers or something because they made them do this or they made them do that. Well, you know, they were doing their job too, you know, trying to. And but I never really witnessed anything in that line, Richard, but I did hear talk about it, yes.
Okay. Did your unit ever function with the K-9 units?
Our work with the dogs, Richard, was sometimes we'd have two or three guys with dogs with us. But for the most part, we kind of operated on our own. The dogs I had the utmost respect for and their handlers. I thought they'd done an excellent job. I'm partial to dogs, and I never ever understood their policy of not bringing those dogs back to the States. I'm glad I wasn't a handler, because it would have broke my heart to you know, see those dogs put to sleep or whatever the case was, you know, because And I do think those dogs saved a lot of men's lives. I really believe that.
Okay. Did your unit use snipers?
We had one guy with us, Richard, that was supposed to have been a sniper. Mm-hmm. We never ever used him for that, and I always used to kid him. His name was Fred Childs. He was from California. And he carried an M14, and I asked him why he carried that M14. He told me he was a sniper, and I always told Fred, I said, "Hey, you wouldn't make a pimple on a sniper's ass." You know, I used to kid him about it a lot. You know, but really, we never ever used Fred for that kind of job.
Mm-hmm. How did you deal with the enemy snipers?
Basically, Richard, it was kind of a guessing game as to where they were at, and what we would do if we thought they were in the trees, we just kind of open up on the trees and stuff around us, you know, and for the most part that pretty well took care of them, but they were so well hidden and so well camouflaged. I mean, you know, you really didn't know where they were at, unless they fired three or four shots in a row, which they were smarter than that.
Right.
I mean, you know, they wasn't going to do that.
Right.
But that's how we took care of them, Richard, mm-hmm. for the most part,
okay.
that I recall.
Tell me about the relationships that you were able to form with the men with whom you served.
I had a pretty good relationship with a lot of the guys, Richard. I got very well acquainted with a gentleman from Mackbee, South Carolina. We got real close, and he came back the same time I did, and I have talked to him in the last 6 or 8 months. I have a friend in Great Falls, Montana, who we are very close and still are today. I have a very good friend in Oceana, West Virginia, that I talk to at least twice a year. Just got through talking to him at Christmas or Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. The thing I regret probably the most, Richard, of that thing was, you know, I got acquainted with a lot of them. Never took their name or their address and telephone number and this kind of stuff, and therefore I'm kind of separated from them today. One gentleman that I would love to get in contact with, and I can't tell you his name, can't tell you where he lives or nothing, and it has haunted me for 30-some years.
Did he serve with you in your unit?
Yes. Mm-hmm. This guy, for some reason, took a liking to me, and whenever we'd go out on patrol or something, I'd come back, and he was with a mortar crew, and he would have me a cold something to drink, you know, or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And I asked him one day, I said, why are you doing this, you know, what's the deal? And he said, well, I said, you know, I like you. And I said, well, I said, you know, I appreciate that, but I said, I've just never had anyone treat me like this, you know. Of course, I think early on I had told you that I come from a broken home and all this, and I just wasn't used to somebody doing anything for me. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I got very well acquainted with this guy, and we were up at Contum when he came to me, and he said, I want to talk to you. After a while, he said, you know, and I thought, well, what's this guy want to talk to me about, you know? And I knew he was married, and I thought, well, maybe he wants to talk about, you know, problems or something he's having with his wife or whatever. And I thought, well, hell, he wouldn't want to be talking to me because I wasn't married. I didn't know anything about his women, you know. And so I did. I went over and talked to him that evening. And come to find out, this guy and his father owned a ranch out west somewhere. And he asked me, what did you do back in the world? This is what we call the United States back in the world. Mm-hmm. And I said, before I come in service, I said, I worked on a farm. And he said, what kind of farm? I said, we raised grain and had a few cattle, you know. And he said, I want to know. He said, would you be interested in coming to work on a horse ranch for me and my dad? And I told him, I said, I couldn't tell you anything about a horse. I said, I've ridden them, but I don't know anything about them. And he said, well, you can learn, can't you? I said, yeah. And he said, well, so I'd like to have you come to work with me and my dad. And I said, well, maybe you ought to ask your dad about this, you know. Well, he did. He wrote his dad and told him, you know, said, hey, I got this guy that I think would work out. And his dad wrote and told him, he said, you know, if you think this guy's, you know, the one for you, why, we can do it. And he told me, he said, when Dad retires, he said, I'll split everything with you 50-50 down the middle. And he come back, Richard, I think like a month or two before I did. So he would come back in September of 68. Mm-hmm. And I come back in November of 68. We came into the same place out at Fort Lewis, Washington. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to stop there and spend 2 or 3 days with him and his wife, and we'd go and make plans and stuff. And for some reason, I didn't do that. I come on home. And I have regretted that ever since. Not maybe that I didn't take the job. It's that I owe the man an apology, you know. And I would love and love, I mean, dearly love to get in contact with this guy, but I don't know his name. You know, I've forgotten it over the years. It's escaped me. I think I would probably recognize the guy if I seen him, but nobody seems to know who I'm talking about. But I had a good relationship with the guys, Richard. I really did. You know, I didn't. Of course, I'm not sure what I told you about this or not, but I run into a guy. This happened at base camp, and he was a colored guy. He pulled a knife on me, and he threatened to kill me. And that didn't happen, but thank God it didn't. But you know, for the most part, I had a good relationship with the guys.
How much contact did you have with home?
With home?
Yes, sir.
When I left to go to Vietnam, Richard, of course, the only people I had was the people that had taken care of me, had raised me, basically, and a girlfriend who I ended up marrying and later on divorced. But those were probably the only three people that I had contact with. Of course, my brother was living at the time, but he was, let's see, how old would he been? He'd been 13, 14 years old when I was over there. He never ever mailed me or, you know, wrote a letter back to him. Of course, I didn't write to him, so I guess he didn't feel like he ought to write to me. But that's probably the only three people I really had any contact with back in the States, and I'd get maybe a couple, three letters a week, mostly from my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever able to make any of the Mars calls?
Yes, I made one. Mm-hmm. And it was back home to Mary and Tony, the people that raised me.
Mm-hmm. How was that call?
It was good. For the most part, of course, you know, when you get through talking, you're kind of let down because, you know, you're over there and we're back here, you know, and everything. And but it was good.
Okay. What would you do for entertainment there?
Well, now you're talking about out in the field, Richard?
Well, just in general.
In general.
If your mind immediately goes out in the field, then yes. If you're talking about base camp and going into town, then that too.
Okay. Out in the field, Richard, we played a lot of cards. Mm-hmm. And basically that was just about, and we listened to Armed Forces Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just about it, Richard. I mean, you know, and I've always told people, you know, that when you worked as hard as we did when we were out in the field, you really didn't feel like doing any games. I mean, you know, you didn't really feel like being entertained, you know, or wanting to do anything. When we did get back into base camp or in town, or close to a town, we would go in you know, try to find something to drink, see the ladies, you know. Basically, that was about it, Richard.
Okay.
That's all I can, you know. Of course, I wasn't in, you know, around Saigon where there was, you know, a lot of things to do. And we were basically, like I said, up north, and we done our business.
Right.
And that was about it.
Right. Were the prostitutes readily available?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Was that pretty much anywhere in
the yes.
town you went into?
Yes.
How would you locate them in a small town? Would they come to you, or would you guys have to go seek them out?
Well, they weren't hard to spot, Richard, if you know what I mean.
Yes, sir.
They were just there. You know, if you seen a little building that had the sign on it called Car Wash or something like that,
uh-huh.
you could pretty much count on that's what it was.
Okay.
you know, and you know, get when I think about it over the years, you know, that was probably the only income that those girls had. And some of those girls, Richard, were very, very pretty women. I mean, they were very pretty women. Of course, what they done at night, you know, to the GIs, I mean, who knows? You know, they may have been VC or NVA at night.
Right.
You know, nobody knows.
Right.
But, yes, they were very, very readily available.
Okay.
And you just really didn't have a problem finding them.
Out of curiosity, do you remember how much it would cost to be with one of these girls?
It was...
and you don't have to answer that question if you don't want to.
Oh, no, that's not a problem. I'm getting myself in a little deep water here, Richard. You know, I'm telling you that I did associate with these girls, but that's not a problem. I think it was like 500 P, mm-hmm. which would have been $5. You know, that was cheap.
Sounds like it.
Oh goodness! Of course, I was kind of wild when I was over there, Richard. You know, I kind of threw caution to the wind, you know.
Mm-hmm. Were your spiritual beliefs affected by the war? Say, you know, how you thought before and then during and then after?
As far as the war itself went, Richard, it didn't really affect my spiritual beliefs, because I knew that, you know, God had, in the Bible, you know, it said there'd been wars and rumors of wars, you know, and this happened in the Bible, I mean, all the time, and I didn't feel bad about some of the things we'd done over there. As far as the killing and stuff that went on, I would say it has bothered me more today than it did then. Maybe it was because it was a life and death struggle. You know, that's about all I know to say, Richard. I mean, you know, as far as that part of it goes, I don't think it's affected me spiritually, no.
Okay. Did you ever get to take any R&R?
Yes, sir.
I think actually we talked about that.
Oh, okay.
How about USO shows?
No.
Okay. Did your unit have any pets?
No.
Okay. Were you ever exposed to any of the defoliants over there, Agent Orange?
Yes.
How so?
Well, through the water system.
Mm-hmm.
When we did run out of water that was flown into us, Richard, we would have to get water out of the streams and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The streams were had this Agent Orange in them. And the reason I say that is because it's already been a proven fact that the defoliant was sprayed from planes as well as helicopters. It was in the airways, and it got into the water system. And I seems like, Richard, I remember one time when they flew over us and was dropping this stuff. And it was just like a shower, you know. I mean, not as intense, but, yes, I was exposed to it.
Have you suffered any effects from it that you think?
None that I'm aware of, Richard.
Okay.
None that I'm aware of. I have, I've talked to some of the guys that was with her in our company that is being affected by it. One of them passed away here about 5 years ago from that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nasty. Very nasty.
What was wrong with him, do you remember?
He had, I think he had leukemia.
Okay.
Or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or something like that.
Okay. Well, speaking of defoliants and taking out the jungle, what did you think of Vietnam, the country itself, physically?
I thought it was a very poor country, mm-hmm. but I also seen the beauty in it too, Richard. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a very pretty country. If you stopped and looked around, I mean, you could see the beauty there. I don't know that the people really wanted it any different than they had it, as far as the maybe their infrastructure went. I think it had a lot of potential, and still does. But I think the people were pretty much content with their way of life as it was. And the country, I mean, you know, it was a beautiful country, Richard.
How would you rate the leadership that you had, first of all, there in your company, and the lieutenants and the captains?
I would rate it as on a scale of 1 to 10. I would probably rate it a 8,
okay.
7, 8,
quite
somewhere.
High.
Yeah.
Okay.
The thing that really bothered me, Richard, with our leadership was I felt like that our higher up people in the division was trying to make calls that they weren't qualified to make, and I say that because they weren't out there with us. They didn't know what the hell was going on. They were sitting back in a secure, air-conditioned office, trying to tell us what to do. But overall, our leadership in the field, I think, was good.
Okay. What would you say was the bravest action you witnessed while you were in country?
Oh, gosh, Richard. That would be pretty hard to I don't know, Richard. I would say excuse me. I'd say that'd be pretty hard. It'd be pretty hard for me to answer, because I seen two or three things that I thought was very, very good. I know we especially had this captain, and when we were in Khantoum, I thought the guy was kind of a sissy, But unbeknownst to me, when the shit hit the fan, I mean, he was right there. I mean, and I had a lot of admiration for this man. But overall, Richard, I just really can't say. I really don't know. I mean, I've seen a lot of guys that done things that I thought was good, and brave. But overall, I'd say I just can't really pick out one thing and say, that was extraordinary,
Do you recall any humorous event besides the monkey incident you described to me?
Humorous?
Mm-hmm.
Not right off the top of my head, Richard. I just can't think of anything.
Okay. What did you think of the media coverage of the war?
I didn't think, Richard, I mean, as far as it being brought back here to our people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it should have been. I think it hurt the GIs, hurt the American fighting people.
How so?
Well, you know, when you have CBS and NBC and all these outfits over there, and they're showing, guys getting hurt or killed,
mm-hmm.
And maybe, some of our guys had captured some NVA or VC prisoners, you know, and maybe slapped them around or done something, you know, this kind of went against us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it lowered the morale of American men. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I think it lost the war force. Because, and the reason I say that is because, I can't think of the gentleman's name. He was a general in North Vietnamese Army. Gip or something.
Giap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He made the comment at the Paris Peace Talks to Henry Kissinger that he said, "We can't beat you on the battlefield, but we'll beat you in propaganda."
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it ultimately cost us the war. In a sense it did, Richard, but also our leaders back here, for some reason or another, and I don't know the answer, don't know, I wish I did know, I think there were things that could have been done in North Vietnam
mm-hmm.
that wasn't done to end that war. You know, just for instance, the lack of artillery on our part,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I think ultimately, Richard, I think it cost us the war. I really do. I don't think that is the place for the news. You know, I don't think the American people need to know what is going on day after day after day after day. You know, and I don't know how to put this, Richard. I can't find the word, but you know, when the American public sees this day in and day in, day out, you know, it kind of turns them against it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then therefore they turn around and say something or have a demonstration or whatever, you know, and it goes against us.
Mm-hmm. Now, you left in November 1968.
Yes, sir.
And you knew the date.
Yes.
You would leave.
Yes.
How did you feel when you were getting short there in that last month or so?
When I was getting short, Richard, I wanted to be in the most secure area I could find.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the units, I know I talked to a buddy. This buddy of mine from West Virginia said that when he got like 2 or 3 months before he came home, he was sent back to base camp.
Really?
You know, yeah. Well, I never had that luxury. You know, I was out there until I think probably 3 weeks anyway, you know, and then I come back, and then I was sent back into base camp and to get things ready to go and to see the doctors and dentists, whatever I needed to see. But yeah, I think the shorter a person got, the more caution or whatever you took, you know, to try to say, hey, I'm going back and I'm going back one piece,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Was that supported by the other men in your company?
Yes.
Okay. Everybody understood.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Tell me about when you left Vietnam. How did you feel?
I felt like a load had been taken off my shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I felt good, Richard, that I was going home, but I also felt bad for the guys that I left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 'cause when you left, you basically lost all ties with these people. You had no way of knowing what that company was doing, mm-hmm. how the guys were doing. It was just one of those things that, you know, you just didn't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was friends that you left behind that, you know, you wonder to this day, you know, how they are.
Right.
But I did feel, I felt glad that I was leaving. You know, and relieved and thankful that I did make it.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that flight back?
Yes.
What was it like?
It was very, very quiet, very solemn.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember the closer we got to the United States, it was kind of pandemonium. I mean, everybody was like, yeah, you know, this is great. You know, and I remember when I left Fort Lewis, Washington, or SeaTac, I guess they called it, to board a plane out there to come back to St. Louis. I remember, I think it was Mount Rainier,
mm-hmm.
and the pilot showed us that,
mm-hmm.
and from then on, Richard, why, you know, I just kind of settled down and I wanted to sleep. And I had one of the stewardess come by and wanted to know if I wanted to lay down. And I said, well, yeah, I want to lay down, but there's no place to lay. And she said, oh, yes, there is. And she took the arm out of this seat, you know, and went and got me a blanket. And, man, I curled up in that seat and I went to sleep. And I never knew nothing until we got to St. Louis. But yeah, it was nice to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
It really was.
Did you bring any souvenirs home with you?
No.
Okay.
Well, I say souvenirs. The only thing I did bring home, Richard, I got some money.
Mm-hmm.
I did have some souvenirs.
Mm-hmm.
I had an NBA flag. I had a knife. And I had a bracelet that was given to me. I give them away before I left country.
Mm-hmm.
Wish I hadn't have. But I did. You know, I didn't. I just wanted to be done with it and be away from it.
Who'd you give them to?
I give them to a guy by the name of Berliner,
mm-hmm.
out of Chicago, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
I just give them to him.
Was he serving with you there in your platoon?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you have any difficulty at the airports when you were home?
No, I didn't really see that, Richard. I just don't. If it was there, it must have been in a different area, and I just don't recall seeing that. If it was there, I kind of ignored it,
mm-hmm.
you know. But as far as being spit on or talked down to, no, I didn't see that.
Now, when you returned, how difficult was it for you to transition back into civilian life?
Well, I think it was very difficult. I remember coming home, Richard, and I hadn't been home probably a week, and I was out in the backyard, and this is in a very, very small town. And there was a gentleman that lived behind us, and I knew Bill and everything, and he was always shooting blackbirds and stuff in his yard, you know, and trees and stuff. And I was out there in the backyard, and he popped off a shot out of 22, and boy, just scared the shit out of me, you know. And I of course, hit the ground, you know, and when you do this, you know, you think, you know, damn, these people going to think I'm nuts, you know. And, I had some difficulty. I had a very bad temper.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being down at Fort Benning, Georgia, and I lived off post. I was married by then.
Mm-hmm.
Lived off post, and lived in a trailer, and I lost my temper there at the trailer one night and beat the hell out of a refrigerator. And, you know, this kind of stuff. And over the years, Richard, I think it's affected me a lot more than I really, really realized until I did start going to counseling. And I don't know, I just, I think it was a transition that was very difficult. It was very difficult. And, you know, I look back, Richard, at the guys that went through World War II, World War I. They didn't know what, at that time, they didn't know what PTSD was.
Right.
I mean, they, yeah, when they came back from World War II, these guys kind of joined the VFW and the Legion, and this, and they had places to go that, they could go down there and drink or do whatever they wanted to do and talk about the situation. And, also, most of those guys come back from World War II in these troop ships and stuff, and it took them, you know, a month to come back. You know, and they can talk about it in these ships and stuff. And we come back, we was out of the field one day and back into the world next. Mm-hmm. And, it was difficult.
Did you talk about it with anyone, or did people ask you about your service?
I had people ask me about it. Most of the time I never talked about it, Richard. I would talk about it with someone who had been there. But for the most part, people that I didn't know that would talk, ask me about it, I would skirt the issue. You know. But I, the friend that I have in Oceania, West Virginia, he and I has talked about it. And, I know he commented to me, you know, it's probably one of the best things he ever done was talk to me about it, you know. But for the most part, you know, you just don't talk about it to somebody that's not been there.
Right. Do you think you've suffered from PTSD?
Absolutely.
Okay. Did you follow the war effort when you left? What was going on over there in Vietnam?
No, not really, Richard. When I got out of the service, I never watched it on TV. Mm-hmm. I just never, just wasn't my thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about it when the United States withdrew in 1973?
When the United States what?
When the United States withdrew from Vietnam in 73.
Well, I thought it was a very large waste, mm-hmm. not only of material, but of the men, you know. I feel, Richard, that we lost 58,000 of our best people. Mm-hmm. Even though I say the best people, a lot of these men come from lower class, such as myself. Mm-hmm. But I think these guys were very talented, a lot of them were. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just a very large waste. You know, I don't think that war should have ever happened. I think it was political. Mm-hmm. And I still say, had John F. Kennedy lived, we wouldn't have had a Vietnam, but we knew it. Mm-hmm. We might have had a Vietnam, but it wouldn't have been that long. Mm-hmm. You know, that's my personal opinion.
What did you think in April 1975 when Saigon fell and the country, South Vietnam, was lost to North Vietnam?
My feelings was when that happened, Richard. I thought those poor people that had fought for the South Vietnamese, mm-hmm. That had fought with us alongside us, the people that had helped us. As far as being out in the field, as well as being in the cities, I mean, you know, the clerks and stuff that had helped the war effort on our side, I felt sorry for them people, because I feel like the United States not only abandoned them, mm-hmm. But You know, I thought about what the North Vietnamese would do to the ones that was in the South, especially if they knew they served in the military, which they had a way of knowing, you know, I'm sure. Even though they took off their uniforms and threw them in Burma and got rid of the weapons and this, that, and the other, you know. I think everything, I think, could have been handled different, Richard. I really felt bad for those people. I really did.
Do you think the United States learned any lessons from the war?
Well, maybe. I think maybe. I think they probably did, Richard. And especially when I say that, I look at the Gulf War. What happened over there? You know, they went in, done a job, and got out. And that's the only way you can do it. I mean, you know, when you go into a fight, you go in to win, and you win and get out. You know, quit pussyfooting around and beating around the bush. You go in there and do the job and get the hell out. You know, I feel like that they did learn some, but there are probably some that they. Probably more lessons that they need to learn. You know, when you, of course, when you're fighting a war on terrorism, it's that's global. You know, and but there were just a lot of things, Richard, that that I think they could have done different that would have ultimately won the war for us. You know, I feel like I don't know. I feel like the guys that was over there. Were kind of used as puppets, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, kind of guinea pigs, you know. We're going to try this and try this, see what happens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I feel about it.
Okay. How do you feel about your own service in Vietnam, looking back at it?
Can you be a little bit more specific, Richard?
Well, looking back at your Vietnam service, are you proud of what you did? Are you proud of your service with the country?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have any problems there. I just wish it had it worked out for the better because, you know, I look back, Richard, and I feel like that the Vietnam veterans were most of the people in the country look at us as losers,
mm-hmm.
You know. And we didn't lose the war. That war was lost in Washington D.C.
Do you think the United States government has taken care of its Vietnam veterans?
No. Absolutely not.
In what way?
Medical.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of Vietnam veterans out here, Richard, that have problems that they're not being compensated for. For instance, myself, I went through this PTSD for 30 years, not knowing what was wrong. So I end up going to a psychiatrist, being evaluated, getting counseling, and I end up getting a small compensation every month. Well, you know, that small check that I get isn't a drop in a bucket. You know, for what I've been through and for what I've put my family through, there's, and I'm not asking for nothing, Richard. I mean, I'm just saying there's no amount of money can take care of that.
Right.
You know, I don't care if it's $1,000 a month or $200 a month. It just, you know, there's nothing that can replace the way you were,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I have bad thoughts. I mean, I'm not saying I don't. I don't think I'm as bad as I used to be. I thought about suicide. I never ever thought about hurting my family, you know, Richard, as far as that went.
Mm-hmm.
But I have had suicidal thoughts. I suffered for 30 years or longer and really didn't know why, you know. And I still see guys today, Richard, that are Vietnam veterans that are out here that don't have nothing. I mean, you know, they can't hold a job. They can't stay with one person, marriage, you know. They've got kids that are strung from here to Texas, you know, and it's a very large burden to carry, you know.
How do you think the war has most affected your life?
Mistrust. I don't trust anybody. Probably the only person I trust is my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And a few close friends. But overall, Richard, I don't trust anybody. I always looked at the downside of things instead of the positive side. And I don't know where you'd call it, inferiority complex or what you would call it. But if I'm in a strange area, I take precautions of, and I don't care if it's daylight or dark. I just take precautions of trying not to get into a situation that I might not be able to get out of. Now, this sounds strange, Richard, but for instance, when I go into a bathroom, I'll push that door all the way over to the wall to make sure there's nobody behind that door. I mean, it sounds stupid, Richard, but that's part of it.
No, sir, it doesn't sound stupid at all.
And when I'm in a restaurant, I always try to sit facing the door so I can see what's going on, you know. And I don't know. It's just that's some of the weird stuff that that I think the Vietnam veterans go through. And, you know, it seems as though, Richard, and what bothers me a lot, and you know, you see guys or people out here getting messed up on this methamphetamines, and that's a doings of their own, you know. And then they turn around and do a Social Security, you know. And damn, Richard, I mean, here's the Vietnam veteran out here. He can't get shit, you know. And he's been through 10 times what them people's been through, and he's still having to prove himself and still having to fight for whatever he gets. And these people, they can get it overnight. And that's not right. It's just not right.
What do you think was the most significant thing you learned while you were in Vietnam?
Probably the most significant thing I learned, Richard, was, now this may sound selfish, but, you know, taking care of number one.
Yes, sir.
You know. I mean, I'm not saying I didn't try to take care of my friends, but, you know, you learn to take care of yourself because there wasn't nobody else going to, you know.
What do you think about Vietnam today?
I think Vietnam today, Richard, I think they're maybe not crying out for help, but I think they would welcome, you know, the help that the United States gives them. Or any other country, as far as that goes. I don't know. I kind of have a problem with the United States helping them because we tried to do that once and they wouldn't let us, you know. And I don't blame I don't totally blame the South Vietnamese. Some of the blame lies there. Most of it lays with North Vietnam. Of course, you know, communist regime, I mean, they think they can do it, and they don't need no help. But, you know, we all need each other. And I don't know, Richard, I still think it's kind of a backward country. I think they're making some progress. And I'll probably never do it, but I would dearly love to go back over there you know, and just see the see how it has changed, you know. But I think the potential's there, Richard, if they'll submit to it, mm-hmm. you know.
Have you seriously thought about going back to visit?
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've thought about it. Yes.
What would you like to do?
I would. I'd like to go back to Benoit mm-hmm. and see that area, and if it was possible to fly on up to Pleiku, go through Kontoon, Dokto, mm-hmm. places like that, you know, where I had been in country, and Bamituk, places like that, you know. I just like to see how much it has changed, and I'm sure that probably I wouldn't even recognize it, mm-hmm. you know. I've talked to guys that was up in the, you know, that has been back mm-hmm. and into the Pleiku area and where Campanari was located, mm-hmm. and it's just all a big overgrown, you know, mess, and, you know, the only thing that they really recognize is Dragon Mountain, you know. But I think it would be interesting to do that, but I don't know.
Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
I have had some, Richard, but very little. We had a Vietnamese engineer mm-hmm. that worked for Marathon Oil Company, mm-hmm. and his name was Son Do. And the guys up there at the plant tried to get me to, you know, do some things to him, make fun of him, I never done that. I said, no, I can't do that, you know. And I turned around and walked away. Well, I did get to talk to him one day. He happened to be up in the supply room there, mm-hmm. and there was just me and him in there, and I asked him, I said, Son Do, I said, where are you from? And he said, Vietnam. I said, yeah, I know that, but I said, south or north? And it got real quiet, and he said, originally, he never turned around, never looked at me. Mm-hmm. He said, originally, I'm from North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. He said, I came down in a boat to the South Vietnamese side, and he said, I was in the Navy. I think he said it was the Navy. And he was I liked the guy. I really did. I mean, you know, he had a nice family, mm-hmm. and, I don't know what happened out there at Marathon, but he ended up quitting mm-hmm. out there. And they still live here in Robinson, Illinois. And I think it's been 2 years ago, Richard, the wife and I were going to Vincennes one evening. Mm-hmm. And just down the highway here a little bit, I seen his car parked over on the side of the road, and his wife or this lady was in there. Mm-hmm. And I turned around, went back, pulled up behind her, mm-hmm. and very, very pretty lady, beautiful lady. Mm-hmm. And I asked her, I said, aren't you Son Do's wife? And she said, yes. And I said, you having problems? And she said, yes. I said, I about lost a wheel or something, you know. And I said, well, I said, I got a cell phone here in a truck. If you want to use it, I said, you can call Son Do or whatever you need to do, you know. I said, you're welcome to use the phone. And she did. She used the phone, called him, and she offered to give me some egg rolls and, mm-hmm. you know, some other stuff that she had in the car. And that's what they do. They make these Vietnamese foods, and they take them around to stores and sell them. That's where they make their living. Mm-hmm. But that's really the only contact that I have had, mm-hmm. Richard,
okay.
you know, with them.
Okay. Are there any songs that you hear on the radio that take you back to Vietnam?
Mostly I listen to country music, mm-hmm. And of course up in here they don't play some of the old country music. They play this modern stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, Richard, I'll hear something that will remind me of that, but not very often.
Mm-hmm.
Not very often.
Okay. How about books on Vietnam? Have you read any?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I'm a nut for that.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I went to Indianapolis over the weekend, mm-hmm. and was up at one of the malls. And that's where I spend my time when we go to the mall or something. If the wife got shopping to do, she goes her way, and I go to Walden Bookstore.
Uh-huh.
And I sit in there and look through these books and try to find something that, you know, to look at. I usually don't buy nothing because they're too expensive, and I just don't have the extra money to to buy these things, you know, although I'd love to bring them home and read them,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I just don't. You know,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, I'm a nut for books.
Okay.
I love to read.
Okay. How about movies on Vietnam? Have you seen these?
I have seen a couple, Richard. For the most part, I don't watch them.
And why is that?
I think it brings back too much memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more I stay away from it, the better off I am. But you know. And the wife gets on me. She don't like me to watch them, you know.
She does not want to like
them? No. Mm-mm.
Why not?
Well, because she thinks it bothers me as far as my mood goes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of hard to get along with for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always snapping at her, you know, or something. But
mm-hmm.
And she don't like that. And I can understand that,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Have you been to the wall in Washington?
Yes, sir.
What was that experience like for you?
I don't know, Richard. It was very, very touching,
mm-hmm.
very solemn. I mean, I felt like I was with those guys,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a very, very touching thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. I don't know how else to describe it, Richard. And I'd love to go back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't agree with the layout of the monument. You know, the way it was in the ground and all, I mean, you know, that was just me.
How do you think they could have done it differently?
Well, to me, Richard, they could have kind of put it, you know, above the ground,
mm-hmm.
and put it into some other color other than black.
Mm-hmm.
Black represents death to me.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the reason they done it, because, you know, that's 58,000 American lives lost, and it is death. I don't know. I mean, I just feel like that it could have been, you know, raised above the ground and done different. But that's not the way it was chosen to be, so, you know, I have to live with that.
Were you able to find Hollis Buck's name?
Yes. Yeah, there was several of them on there, Richard, that I found.
Did you do one of the rubbings?
Yes.
Okay. For young people today, if you were to talk to high school or college students and tell them about the Vietnam War, what would you tell them?
I don't really know, Richard. You know, that's something I have never really, I've never really thought about it. I would try to make it a positive experience for them,
mm-hmm.
rather than something negative,
mm-hmm.
you know. You know, but I just really haven't thought a whole lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
I just really don't know, Richard, what I would, how I would address that.
Okay. Sir, is there anything else you'd like to add to our conversation?
Nothing that I can think of, Richard, right off the top. you know, I just wish things had been different, you know, mm-hmm. with Vietnam. I wish that we could have come back and been looked upon as good warriors or good fighting men, mm-hmm. which didn't happen. And I think the Vietnam veterans as a whole, I think, is probably talked about negatively more than probably any of us, any of the fighting or any of the wars that's going on. I have heard myself in VFWs and stuff, you know, the World War II guys talking, you know, and said the comment was made that, yeah, give them a good platoon, they'd clean that whole damn country out. Well, bullshit. You know, don't sit and tell me that. I know better, you know. But there's really nothing else, Richard, that I can think of that I would like to add. But should something come up, why, you know, I'll give you a call. And if something comes up on your end that you would like to ask, mm-hmm. feel free to do so.
Okay.
But there's nothing that I can think of right now, Richard.
Okay. Well, this will end our oral history interview with Elmer Hale. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.